believe we have a quorum, so we'll go ahead and call the meeting to order at 6:01. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. My name is John Cabot. I'm the chair of the Northern RAC, and I represent the non-consumptive user, and I'm from Hooper. We're going to go ahead and do introductions, so let's go ahead and start over with Joel.
I'm Joel Ferry. I represent agriculture from Brigham City.
I'm Bruce Soloto. I represent the U.S. Bureau of Land Management.
Robert Sanchez, the Forest Service.
Matt Clark, public at large.
Bryce Thurgood, at large, Perry, Utah.
Kristen Purdy, Ogden, non-consumptive.
John Wall, Riverdale, public at large.
Mike Lauder, sportsman's rep, Hooper.
Justin Oliver, West Haven, at large.
Russ Lawrence from Ogden, public at large.
Justin Doling with the Division of Wildlife Resources. I serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
Okay, I'd also like to recognize Byron Bateman, who is a member of the Wildlife Board, and we appreciate you attending tonight. Please join me, if you would, and turn off any cell phones. Turn your ringers off so we can have an uninterrupted meeting. The purpose of tonight's meeting is to gather input from the public regarding wildlife management policy and rules and regulations. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board then considers the recommendations from the five regional advisory councils and sets policy for all protected species in Utah. Please respect everyone's right to an opinion, even if it's in conflict with yours, and so there's no need for any clapping or vocal outbursts. This meeting will be recorded tonight, and for the transcriptions of the minutes, and the audio recording and minutes will be available on DWR's website. When speaking, please use the microphone. The public is asked to use the microphone up there at the podium. And speakers should state their name and, if they wish, where they're from. Okay, if you could go ahead and take a look at the agenda for tonight's meeting. If there is no objection, we will go ahead and approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. Seeing no objection, the agenda for tonight's meeting is approved. The next business in order is the approval of the minutes from the last meeting. Everyone should have received a copy of the minutes in an email. Are there any corrections to the minutes from last time? Seeing none, the minutes from the last meeting are approved as circulated. The next business in order is old business, and that old business would be the Wildlife Board update. The Wildlife Board met on October 1st. The items on the agenda for consideration included the items that we discussed at our last meeting, primarily the fishing guidebook and Rule R657-13. That was approved unanimously. And then several other items were included on the Wildlife Board agenda that were not within our meeting. Those included conservation permit annual reports, conservation permit audit, and the conservation permit allocation. All of those were approved unanimously by the Wildlife Board. They also set the 2016 RAC and board dates. Those are available on the DWR website as well. And then a final action item that was not on our agenda was a request to submit a letter to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regarding Mexican wolves. And so it was a multi-state effort that the Wildlife Board went ahead and signed on to. Okay, so that is all of the old business that I have. Are there any questions on the Wildlife Board update? Okay, the next item, business in order, is the regional update from Justin Dolan.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome out to the RAC meeting. We've got a full agenda tonight, so I thought it'd be pretty brief and just run through some of the things that are occurring here in our region by each one of the sections. In our aquatic section, we have a Weber River Confluence Conference coming up Thursday and Friday. This is the second annual conference where stakeholders in the Weber River have joined to talk about the future of the Weber River and how we protect that watershed. Our aquatic staff also hosted recently a reservoir fish habitat partnership meeting, and that was folks that came throughout all the western states to gather up and talk about how to essentially create habitat for aquatic species, primarily fish, in reservoir environments. As far as fishing this fall, they say Pine View will be good fishing for crappie, particularly after the ice sets on. So if you want to catch crappie this winter, they're anticipating a good population of crappie at Pine View. Right now, the Weber Blacksmith's Fork and the Weber are fishing very well, both stream environments. And then if you like to fish for whitefish, it's kind of a unique species here in Utah. The whitefish run will be starting at Bear Lake in early December, and that could be quite fun. The whitefish up there run pretty good size. In our habitat section, we're doing a lot of projects out in West Box Elder now with juniper removal using bull hogs. We're following up that with an aerial seeding, and we've got several projects going on out there, and things are looking quite good for sage grouse and mule deer in the area. And then as far as our future plans for habitat projects, this is the time of the year when our staff starts to build projects for next year. So we're generating ideas and working with the federal land agencies and the private landowners to generate projects for the upcoming season. In our wildlife section, they're just starting our deer classifications, postseason deer classifications. If anybody on the RAC has an interest in joining a biologist in the field to help conduct those classifications, please contact either myself or Randy Wood, and we can definitely get you scheduled to do that. It's a good time of the year to be out looking at mule deer because of the rut and their high profile right now. For the pheasant season, we have plans to release a little over 500 pheasants each week throughout the season. We have some extended seasons here in northern Utah on state and federal land, and so we should have plenty of birds out there for hunters to come out and try their luck at. In our outreach section, the outreach section has been working with an Eagle Scout that's a special needs Eagle Scout, and he's trying to develop a project, and it looks like it's going to get kicked off this Saturday, the 14th, at the Kaysville Ponds. And his dream is to try to introduce special needs folks to fishing and outdoor recreation. So we're going to be helping with that event out of Kaysville. You're welcome to come out and join and participate or just observe. We're hoping for a really good turnout there. The Elk Festival at Hardware Ranch will be on December 12th. They have what they call a biathlon event. They're going to have guys with muzzleloaders and gals with muzzleloaders have a snowshoe race and then shoot at targets with the muzzleloaders. And I think that will occur even if we don't have snow. It's still awkward to work snowshoes regardless of snow or no snow. So in our law enforcement section, they indicate we had good participation in the pheasant hunt opener. We do have two new officers coming into the region this coming January. Wesley Shelby will be our new Colville officer, and Jordan Hastings will be our new East Box Elder officer. And for the Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Program, the brine shrimp harvest season, cyst harvest season, is still underway. They have currently harvested approximately 11 million tons of brine shrimp cysts so far, so it's been a good season for them. The swans are really starting to come in pretty hot and heavy. We've got about 25,000 swans here in the state. Most of them are congregated around Bear River and the associated clubs, but they are starting to move south into Harold Crane and Ogden Bay. So as the season progresses, they'll continue to move south into Farmington Bay and some of the South Shore Duck Clubs. So far, the waterfowl season's been a little slow, but we're hoping for a little better weather for waterfowl hunting. So with that, I entertain any questions that you may have about the region or the update. Okay, just as a reminder, if you do want to get involved in the postseason mule deer classifications, feel free to drop me a line. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Justin. I'm going to go ahead and kind of review the operating procedure for tonight's meeting for those of you that haven't attended a RAC before. The meeting will proceed as follows. A representative from the Division of Wildlife Resources will make a presentation on the agenda item. We will then turn to questions from the public on the presentation. And this is a time where the public can ask questions only, no comments. We will then move to the RAC, which will ask questions from the council or on the presentation. And then we will take comments from the general public on the agenda item. Each person that would like to make a comment, we ask that you fill in a blue comment card, which is located at the back of the room, and then pass those up either side of the council members so that we can have a record of your comment. At the end of the public comment period, we'll then move back to the RAC. The RAC will comment, and then we will have any kind of motion at that time from the RAC, and then a vote on that motion. Any council members who wish to abstain from voting should state their conflict, and council members voting in opposition to a motion should also provide a reasoning for that. We will then move on to the next agenda item and so forth until the conclusion of the meeting. Okay. All right. We will go ahead then with our next agenda item, which is the waterfowl recommendation and rule amendments for 2016 by Blair Stringham. Oh, just a second. We had some RAC members that came in after the introduction, so can you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves? I guess it was just Star.
I'm Craig Van Tassel. I'm a sportsman representative from Camas.
John Blazard from Camas, representing agriculture.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Blair.
And so tonight we're going to be doing our selections for the 2016-17 season. That'll allow us to set the seasons well in advance, as well as to get our guidebooks printed earlier, which is going to be a big help for waterfowl hunters. They'll be able to plan their seasons accordingly and know exactly what recommendations will be well ahead of time. So I wanted to start with a brief update on habitat conditions. This is a map just looking at the last 2 years across the northern United States and Canada. For the most part, conditions were a little bit worse habitat-wise than they were last year. And we saw the prairie pothole regions up through Saskatchewan and Alberta were a little bit drier than they have been in previous years. But for the most part, we still had pretty good breeding conditions for our birds in the spring of 2015. I'm looking at the continent, or United States-wide here. Really, we've seen drought patterns kind of come and go. Something that's been fairly concerning for us, though, here in the Pacific Flyway is the drought that we've been experiencing in California. Many of our waterfowl, as they move through Utah, head towards California to winter. And as you can see, the drought has become quite severe through the Central Valley of California and really where a lot of these birds winter. So that has become quite an issue for us in the Pacific Flyway. The Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as the California Department of Fish and Game, have been looking at ways that they can conserve water in those areas and try to provide as much habitat as possible for wintering birds. So we'll continue to monitor that, but it may become more and more serious if this drought continues in that part of the country. Looking at our waterfowl populations, for ducks over the last 15 years or so, we've had excellent conditions. Really, each year we've seen an increase for the most part. This year we had the largest breeding duck population on record, just shy of 50 million birds. So ducks across the continent are looking great. Looking at individual species, really not a whole lot of change from last year. We saw a little bit increase in teal and shovelers and a little bit in canvasback. For the most part, things are about the same as they were in 2014. Looking at the long-term averages, most waterfowl species are well above their long-term average. We do have pintail and scaup, which have been below their long-term averages for some time now, but for the most part, most birds are doing excellent. For Rocky Mountain population of Canada geese, they continue to look really good as well. Continue to see them increasing for the most part for the last 30 or 40, 50 years. Light geese are a similar trend, and we've seen them continue to increase gradually here in the western part of the continent, and they're continuing to do excellent. As well as our tundra swan population, they've continued to follow that similar trend of increasing over the last 50 or so years. So the way that our seasons are based, it's based on our western population of mallards. And so this year, the mallard population was doing excellent. And so we can recommend a liberal season again, which is 107 days in a 7-bird bag. We do have three species that are under species-specific harvest strategies. Those are pintail, canvasback, and scaup. For pintail and canvasback, we have the most liberal package, which is 107-day season and a bag of two. For scaup, because their populations are down somewhat, we do have a reduced season of 86 days and a bag limit of three. And so for our season dates this year, our hunt will be for 2016. Our hunt will begin on October 16th and run until January 15th. For that reduced scaup season, it'll begin on October 1st and go till the 27th of December. Bag and possession limits will be similar to what they have been in past years, with two hen mallards, two wood ducks, two redheads, two pintails, two canvasbacks, and three scaup. All their bags and season for coot, snipe, and the falconry seasons are the same as they have been for quite some time now. For swan season, the season dates will be from October 1st till December 11th. That'll be specifically for the Great Salt Lake Hunt area, and we'll be able to issue 2,000 permits again for the swan season. For dart geese, we had some controversy last year over the northern goose zone, and as we went to the Wildlife Board, they recommended that we go back and try to get some more input from hunters across the state on the goose zone changes. And so in July, we sent out a survey to all of our goose hunters, asking them a preference for a zone change, as well as looking at the timing of the season break to see if we needed to make any adjustments there. Once we concluded that survey, we took the feedback we received and had an open house in August in Brigham City and presented some new recommendations based upon that feedback that we'd received from that survey. So what we found is that, for the most part, about 55% of hunters were in favor of having some kind of adjustment to that northern goose zone, with 36% of people being opposed to that. We took those survey results further and broke them down into three specific groups. And we looked at public land hunters, which are specifically hunting private property, found that about 55% of those people were looking for some kind of a change in northern goose zone, as opposed to 36 who were against. We looked at private land hunters that were hunting specifically private land that wasn't a club, and about 66% of those individuals were looking for a change, opposed to 29% that weren't looking for a change. And then for our club hunters, we found that only about 42% of those people wanted to see adjustment in the zone, and 53 or 54% of those guys didn't want to see a change. We also found that as far as timing of the split in the season, for the most part, people still preferred that late October season or split time frame, which we've been done for quite a while now. We took those recommendations, looked at our zone that we currently had, and found that for the most part, if we were to adjust that to largely include people within public land areas or hunting clubs and keep that season date continuous, we could probably do a split with the rest of the zone, which includes, for the most part, a large amount of public and private land, and really satisfy the needs of both of our users. And so this is what we presented to people at our open house. For the most part, our feedback was really strong for this new configuration of zones. I mean, it seemed like it met the needs of most of the users, as well as provided a lot more hunter opportunity. We decided to keep Bear River Refuge within that northern goose zone boundary, which allows people to have a public land area to go and hunt geese when the remainder of the state's closed. And really that provides about 128 days of straight goose hunting in the state. We are only allowed 107 per zone, but if we shift those dates around a little bit, it gives someone an opportunity to hunt geese for a lot longer than they otherwise would, so it provides a lot more hunter opportunity. And so our goose dates we're recommending this year for the northern zone would be October 1st through January 14th. For the urban zone and the rest of the state zone, it would be split after the 13th of October. The urban zone would resume on November 5th and run until February 5th. And for the rest of the state, it would be from October 22nd until January 22nd. For light goose hunt, we also had an opportunity to readjust our boundaries here as we looked at the northern goose zone. What we tried to do is pattern our season dates out over when we actually have light geese here in the state. For the most part, we don't see a whole lot of light geese move through in the fall. It's largely a spring hunt as these birds are moving from California back north to their breeding grounds. And so we created a little bit of time in the fall when we typically see light geese here in the state. Usually around Corinne area, we start seeing them show up around the 20th, 25th of October. They'll stay for about a month and leave when things freeze up. And so we're keeping the season open during that period. And then adding the rest of the time that we have for our snow goose hunt on the last part of the season. This will allow hunters across the state to pursue light geese as they move back north. With the exception of Millard County, we are recommending a change from February, or a closure from February 6th through the 28th. This is to accommodate the snow goose festival that occurs down there. And this should give time for birds to start staging and hanging out. I'm going to cement a reservoir in preparation for that that festival, and then we'll resume the hunt on March 1st like we have in the past. And we're also recommending closing all of our WMAs across the state except for Clear Lake. In the past, we have kept public shooting grounds in Salt Creek open for this hunt, but we rarely ever see snow geese actually using those areas, so there really hasn't been any opportunity for hunters. And with this change in the dark goose hunt, this will allow those managers to have a little more time to provide for muskrat hunter or muskrat trappers and other things that are going on in the WMA during that time. So that's the reason for that closure. And lastly, we are recommending a change this year in the age for our youth hunters. The last couple of years, we've been trying to adjust all of our hunting to allow for 17 and younger to be the definition of youth. This has been a challenge for us with waterfowl because they're a migratory bird. And so we had to follow the definition that was given to us by the Fish and Wildlife Service. We've been working with them, and this year we're going to be able to change that to 17 and younger. So anybody who is younger than 18 on July 31st of 2016 will be considered a youth. So we'll be able to apply both for the youth swan tags as well as participate in the youth hunt. Two stipulations, though, that are required of this is that kids will have to have an adult with them who's 18 or older. And this is a federal requirement that we'll have to adhere to. So even though 16 and 17-year-olds, by definition, can hunt the rest of the year by themselves, they would have to have a mentor with them at that date. They're also, anyone older than 16 would also be required to have a duck stamp, which is also a federal regulation. And so really the only change we're looking to do this year for our rule is just to change the youth age from 15 to 17. And that is all we have for waterfowl recommendations. Thank you.
Is the falconry limitation federal or state regulated?
It's also federal regulated. They have different requirements, though, as far as possession and bag limits, and those are federal regulated as the 3-daily bag limit and the 9 possession.
Any other questions? Okay, then we'll proceed to comments from the public. If you would like to make a comment, please make sure that you fill in a comment card. I don't have any on this agenda item. Would anybody like to comment? Check. Okay, so we'll move then to the council. Comments on the presentation?
John, I'd like to make a comment.
Okay, go ahead, Joel.
Okay. I just want to thank Blair for the hard work that he's put into this effort. I know there were a lot of changes being made to the waterfowl season. I think this is a really good fit that will work for everybody out there, so thank you. And I support this. It's a good thing.
I second that. You've managed to accommodate everybody and make everybody happy, so that's great.
I did receive a letter just this week from the Chesapeake Duck Club, and they also wanted to indicate their support for these changes as well. So, any other comments? Okay. Yeah, Russ.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we recommend that we move forward the waterfowl recommendations and rule amendment for 2016.
Okay. Second. We have a motion from Russ Lawrence and a second from Joel Ferry regarding accepting the proposed changes made by the DWR. Any comment on the motion? Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, it's unanimous. Okay, the next item on the agenda are the statewide elk management plan revisions by Justin Shannon, Big Game Coordinator.
This childproof. How do you get it all in one slide here? All right. My name is Justin Shannon, and I'm the Big Game Coordinator for the state of Utah, and tonight I'm going to present the statewide elk plan. But before I do, I want to welcome the new RAC members that were called to serve in July of this last year. Look forward to working with you on lots of big game issues moving forward. So to begin, though, as way of introduction, the statewide elk plan that I'm going to present tonight, it provides guidance and direction for managing Utah's elk herds, and it's being presented as a 7-year plan. And the changes that we make and the content that's contained within the plan, it's going to future elk recommendations will be made in accordance with the content of the plan that's passed tonight. Also, before I begin, I want to thank many members of the public that came and helped serve on the elk committee meeting. This wasn't a division effort. We had a pretty diverse group of individuals, sportsmen, landowners, agricultural representatives, federal partners, the public at large, universities, elected officials, individuals like that, that really helped shape the content of this plan, and RAC members. Craig for the Northern RAC served on it, and we were lucky to have him. But I want to say thanks to these committee members before I present the plan, because they did a lot of hard work in putting this together. So to begin, we held 5 meetings from June 2nd to August 11th, and there was roughly 25 hours spent on content, sitting in a room, working through the issues that we struggled with. And our approach was a good one. I really liked how we went about this. The first meeting we had,
we listed what was working well with our current elk management strategies, and then we made a pretty long list of areas that we can improve. And from there, we developed meaningful goals, objectives, and strategies to address the list of where, you know, areas we can improve items on the list. And it was really good because that way, as we made changes to the elk plan, they were to serve a purpose. They were to try to make something that was deficient better. And it was a good approach, in my opinion. We broke the plan up into three different strategy or sections. The first was a population section. The second was a habitat. And then the third was a recreation component. And so for the population management goal for this section is to improve management of Utah's elk populations. And we didn't set a statewide elk population objective like we did in the last plan. Rather, we simply stated that the sum of objectives contained in the unit plans would equal the statewide objective, similar to what we did with the deer plan last year. The first objective we had in the population section was to maintain healthy elk populations at biologically and socially sustainable levels. And with that, I'm going to list some strategies. It's not all of them, but these are the ones that we either changed or that were pretty high profile as we went through the planning process. The first strategy was to set objectives and manage elk at appropriate spatial scales that account for migration patterns. And then the second was that we had established advisory committees when we're reviewing these management plans, and particularly when we're looking at making a change to the herd size objectives. We want to do that with public input. Another strategy is that if drought conditions and high elk densities are negatively impacting habitat, then we'd recommend more antlerless elk permits at the August Wildlife Board meeting. We also wanted to get pretty aggressive with elk during hard winters and allow, this is a new one too, allow muzzleloader bull hunters to harvest a cow on select units that are over objective, similar to what we do with archery elk, where archery elk you can harvest a bull or a cow, although this wouldn't be statewide. This would be on specific units that were chronically over objective, and getting the harvest has been difficult, and adding more hunters may not necessarily be the answer. Another strategy that we came up with as a committee and the division supports is increasing the number of general season cow elk a hunter may harvest annually. In the past, it's been to either two cows or a bull and a cow, and moving forward, we wanted to see that increase, but with that, only allow one cow elk permit to be obtained through the public draw. Moving on to the second objective, I felt like we need to do a better job of fostering support among stakeholders for our elk management program. And the way to go about this in our minds was to address all depredation problems in a timely and efficient manner, try to increase some tolerance there, do a better job communicating with our stakeholders, and then increasing tolerance by public land grazers by focusing habitat restoration projects in areas that we felt would benefit livestock and wildlife. The third objective was to achieve a proper distribution of elk on private and public lands. This is a big one for us. We spent a lot of time in the committee talking about this very issue here, and some of the strategies that we'd like to try over the life of this plan is to create a private lands only permit that would encourage the target of cow elk harvest on private lands. So this would be a permit that, again, would be recommended within a unit, and it would only be valid on private lands, and you could get some good elk hunting pressure and harvest in areas and encourage elk to use public lands and help the public hunters while increasing tolerance of public or private landowners. We also want to investigate an incentive program for landowners that they would qualify for a bull elk permit based on allowing cow harvest. That hasn't been fleshed out yet, but it's something that we'd like to look at soon and try to implement. And then we also want to review eligibility requirements for landowner incentive programs to increase cow elk harvest and or improve the elk distribution. Moving on to habitat, the goals are pretty straightforward. Conserve and improve elk habitat throughout the state. Our objective is to maintain sufficient habitat to support our current elk populations and reduce competition between elk and livestock. One way we wanted to go about this was by increasing forage production or habitat restoration areas of 40,000 acres annually of elk habitat. And then with the Watershed Restoration Initiative, we wanted to keep that momentum going, coordinate with our partners, and do meaningful projects in areas that benefit elk. We also want to promote let-burn policies in appropriate areas that are going to benefit elk and reseed post-wildfires, especially on these summer ranges where we feel like if there was some disturbance, our elk populations and deer populations for that, they would both benefit. And then finally, support programs such as conservation easements and other incentives to keep elk habitat zoned as elk habitat. Second objective is to reduce adverse impacts to elk, whether it's the populations or the habitat. We want to continue working with UDOT. They've done a really good job of highway fencing, underpasses, overpasses. We'd like to keep that momentum going. And then coordinate with land management agencies and energy developers for your oil, gas, and mining mitigation. Moving on to recreation, this is the last section of the plan. The goal was to enhance recreation opportunities for hunting and viewing elk. And our first objective is to maintain a diversity of elk hunting opportunities. So with that, focusing on general season units, have a strategy to continue to issue 15,000 statewide spike permits. And if we have a year where harvest is greater than 20% statewide of spikes, those permits will be reduced to 14,000 the following year. I'd like to recommend 15,000 any bull permits for the life of the plan as well. This is up by about 700 from the last plan. We were at 14,300. But we've grown a lot of elk on our any bull units since then. And so we felt like these round numbers that would equal 30,000 general season permits would be a good fit. We want to continue to issue unlimited archery permits that would be valid both on spike and any bull units. And then this is one that personally I'm pretty excited about, investigate a dedicated hunter program for elk. Again, that we don't have details on that yet, but it's something we want to do early in the life of this plan. Moving on to limited entry, we still want to continue to provide four categories of age class objectives, ranging from 4.5 to 5-year-old bulls all the way up to 7.5 to 8-year-old bulls that were harvested. And the other thing we did with the elk committee is we determined what units in the state would be limited entry, and not only that, but what age objective we'd be managing for. And so some of the things we took into consideration as we were working through this is population size. A lot of our units that have really large populations tend to be in that 5.5 to 6-year-old unit, so there's some quality, but we could also get hunters through the system. Interchange with neighboring units, that if we have limited interchange, that lent itself well to some of the older age objectives. Access to elk, units with lots of roads, easy to get to, some of that stuff. We felt like lower age objectives made more sense there. And then proximity to urban areas. Other considerations was point creep, how many people we have applying every year versus how many permits we're actually issuing, the management of neighboring states and tribes, private land dynamics, and then simply unit histories on some of these units. So some of the changes that we made, it doesn't show up very well, but so I'll read it. On the left there, we're recommending changes in 6 of the units. We have 4 that are recommending increases in the age objective, and then 2 that we're recommending decrease. So the first is on the south cache. Recommend increasing that to a 6.5 to 7-year-old unit. Felt like for the northern part of the state, there wasn't a standout quality elk unit until you started moving south. And so there was a lot of conversation and discussion about where that should be, and the south cache was a good fit. Recommend managing elk on the deep creeks for a 7.5 to 8-year-old bull. And then the next 3, the Mountain Dutton, Panguitch Lake, and Monroe, those are the orange ones kind of there at the bottom and in between the red. In the past, Mount Dutton and Panguitch Lake has been managed for a 5.5 to 6-year-old bull, and the Monroe has been managed for a 7.5 to 8-year-old bull. But we get movement quite a bit in those units, and so we felt like instead of having a 2-year age gap between those, let's bring the Monroe down, bring the other units up, and manage those out collectively for the same age class. And then finally, recommend a decrease on the Pilot Mountains from 5.5 to 6 to 4.5 to 5-year-old bull. Some other strategies. This first bullet wasn't a change from the last plan. Our permits will be broken down as 25% archery, 60% rifle, 15% muzzleloader. And that may vary depending if we're trying to meet a management need. And then the next one is this is something we want to try. On appropriate limited entry units, we want to provide a mid-season and or late-season rifle elk hunt to increase hunter opportunity and improve hunter distribution. And so in the past, we've had early rifle hunts and late rifle hunts. And if we have a late rifle hunt to any degree, no more than 60% of those permits can be in the early rifle hunt is what that is. That's a change from 65% in the last one. But also with the mid-season elk permit, that would be in early October, and it would overlap the spike hunts on some of these units. So you'd be hunting spikes, cow elk, and limited entry bulls with the rifle. And again, the reason for that is to move some of the hunting pressure out of the early September, that early rifle hunt, pull some of that back later, and then also provide another rifle hunt that would have easier draw odds is essentially what we're trying to explore with this. Second objective of the plan for recreation is to increase opportunities for viewing and do a better job of educating of the importance of elk management and elk habitat. We want to do a better job using social media and other media outlets to promote elk management and elk habitat, and then highlight the importance of the conservation permit program, expo permits, the watershed restoration initiative, habitat council, those types of things in improving elk habitat. Kind of do a better job of where this money comes from and how it's used. So in summary, the plan is going to provide direction and guidance for management of elk over the next 7 years. And if I could sum up this plan in one bullet point, it would be the next one. The plan aims to provide wildlife biologists more tools to manage to population objectives, better distribute elk, and provide recreation hunting opportunities. And again, I want to thank those that served on the committee and donated so much of their time and energy towards it. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Justin. It's time to move to the public for any questions on the presentation for Justin. Please state your name.
Robert Burns. Justin, during your meetings, did you talk about widening the age objective classes so that it wouldn't be so hard to manage for a half a year range in each one of those four? Or did you talk about maybe reducing the number of classes? You said you want to stay with four. So could you talk about those? And then on your slide, it had... It was talking about age objectives of 4.75, 6.75. I guess you just averaged your two ends to get that value. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah, let me take a stab at this. If I miss one, remind me. So the question on did we talk about widening it from, say, a 5.5 to 6 to a 5 to 6-year-old unit like we had maybe 5-6 years ago, those conversations never came up. We just never talked about them. The division's comfortable with the half-age objective, trying to manage to that. So no discussion on that. As far as then having four limited entry units, we did talk about that. There was conversations about doing away with the 4.5 to 5-year-old age class. But as we talked about it, there's some real advantages to having some of these units stay as limited entry, even though we're not managing for really top-end quality. And we felt like by keeping that in there, we had more flexibility with seasoned age, because when you turn that over to an any bull unit, you lose all that flexibility and when you can really have a limited entry season. And so that was probably the biggest reason to keep some of these at 4.5 to 5. So.
Any other questions from the public? Okay, council, questions? Russ.
So, Justin, looking at the habitat management and watershed restoration initiative and stuff, I'm assuming a lot of that is actually summer range improvements rather than winter range.
Yeah.
And that was the assumption I made, but you also looked at impacts to other wildlife species as well while you were, you know, looking at those considerations.
Yeah, we did. I think we have, I can't remember the exact language, but there's some strategies to look at aspen and those types of summer range related areas, but there's a lot of discussion on we don't want to manage our elk to the detriment of private landowners or other wildlife or that type of competition, and so we felt like if we could improve habitat statewide on elk winter ranges, other species would benefit, whether it's livestock or deer or other things like that. So.
Thank you. And, you know, aspen regeneration obviously is a big deal, and, you know, how to do that is challenging at times. So thanks for those considerations.
Back to your slide on the mid-season hunter opportunity.
That one?
Yeah. So on appropriate ones, which I think they're all appropriate, but who's decides that? How soon are you going to implement that? I mean, in my opinion, that's, I don't know, the glimmer of hope in this whole thing that they might blow that up. But when will you do that, and what's about, the goals on that?
About 10 minutes. So it'll be part. So that came off as I didn't mean that to be smart, but really, the next presentation will be.
I'll take it personally, Justin.
Okay. Yeah. I hope that didn't sound bad. Wasn't it? Yeah, the next presentation will have some of that.
Yeah, quick question. I was happy to see one of the strategies to increase youth participation. And when you all were having that conversation, did the idea of providing bonus points for youth to put in for those youth hunts and don't draw, did anything like that ever come up so that then those youth that are trying to participate would maybe have a better chance sometime in the youth of drawing?
You know, we didn't get in the weeds on it. I think it's more of a like a concept that as we're making decisions over the next 7 years, make sure we're doing what we can to include the youth. We didn't come out with a lot of specific strategies that say, you know, work with these bonus points or cut off this many permits. We really didn't go there. It was more of a hunter recruitment, retention. That's kind of the things that we're after. And so if that's the philosophy we can have in the plan, we will. So.
Other questions? Back to that real quick, though. Will you meet annually, review that, make more recommendations as the Elk Group Advisory Committee? I'm saying, you know, hey, that worked great on those few units. Let's expand this type of deal.
Oh, you're talking the early October hunts?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as part of what we wanted to do is, as we were talking about this idea, there are some concerns with it, that you'd be having limited entry hunts with spike hunters. Is that provide law enforcement conflicts and some of that. I don't know all the answers. There's certainly concerns there. Some of that was discussed at the committee. A lot of it was discussed internally. So on this, Bryce, I think it's one of these things where we try it on some of these units. We pick some units, implement it, and see what it looks like. We get feedback from hunters. We look at law enforcement concerns, complaints, those types of things. And is it something that the public wants, and if so, let's keep doing it. I think we needed some more information on it before we rolled it all out statewide. So.
Anyone else? Okay, we'll turn to the public for comments. I only have one comment card on this particular agenda item. Mr. Burns. Remember, if you are representing yourself, you have 3 minutes, and if you're representing a group, you have 5.
Thank you. You know, sitting up on the council for quite a few years, when you come around and you look at if a unit is meeting our age classification, our age objective, we have a really tight range on those in this management plan, half a year basically on each group. So we're usually over or under, very rarely on that three-year average that we're looking at those years are we right on. But the management plan does have that. They also look at trend. So that kind of adds a little bit of a buffer. It would be nice if those age objectives were a little bit bigger. But I would recommend that you recommend the Wildlife Board approve the elk management plan as presented. It sounds like it's a pretty good plan, and maybe in the future we can look at broadening those ranges just so we're within our objective more often, because we're out quite often. Thank you.
Thank you. Troy Justinson, I have a comment card for you.
Yeah, Troy Justinson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. Sportsman Fish and Wildlife supports the statewide elk plan with the exception of the Monroe. Our group has asked to leave the Monroe at the current age status rather than bumping it down. Other than that, we support the statewide plan. Now, speaking on myself, I had the opportunity to sit on this committee, and what a privilege it was. I do think, you know, like Justin stated, we all have a given award. We spent 25 hours with John Bear. Anybody survives that, you deserve something. But on a serious note, I think the biggest thing we accomplished in this is giving the individual biologists the sideboards and the parameters to work in. We didn't want to create a plan that was statewide blanketed that you have to do it this way. Now is the opportunity for individuals, for sportsman groups, whatever, to get with their local biologist and see what fits and works within that unit to make it the best it can, to provide opportunity to keep quality, whatever. And I think we've done a pretty good job. You know, granted, we didn't get everything done. Hats off to Blair. I hope we've done as good a job as Blair did with the waterfowl thing. You know, it speaks volumes that you didn't have anybody here speaking against it, and hats off to you there. I hope we can accomplish the same thing with the elk. And it's a work in process, and it takes involvement. So hopefully we provided that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Can you fill out a comment card?
I sent one in, but you didn't.
Is your name Luann?
Yes.
So you have it for number 7. Do you want to speak on this one as well? This is the state elk management plan.
Okay. I do have a comment on this, because it's concerning to me.
Okay. Can you just state your name?
Oh, yeah. It's Luann Schaefer, and I am the trustee for the Evan O'Kohler Revocable Living Trust. And I noticed here on your elk hunt, you have the Meadowville, it's mostly private lands, which, to me, offering me a elk permit to hunt elk, that doesn't cut it. As private landowner, we have had so many problems with people trespassing. Whether we have elk on our property or not, they come. And it doesn't matter how well we're posted or how cultivated our fields are, they still come. So where it's private land, I don't know why it is opened up to the general public to buy permits for that private land so that they can just come and step on at any time. And that's my only concern with this, with the elk presentation.
Thank you. Okay, we will now turn to the council for comment and or motions.
Can I?
Yeah.
Troy? I'd just like to bring a question back to you. Did they say why they didn't want the age objective on the Monroe to be lowered, just to maintain the quality on older age class bulls? I was just looking for clarification. Thank you.
Troy is shaking his head in the affirmative.
That was a yes from Troy.
Any other comments from the RAC? Motions? I guess we're ready for a motion. No more comments.
Mr. Chair, I would make the motion that we forward a recommendation that the Wildlife Board adopt the elk management plan as presented. Is that okay?
Yep, that's good. We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
So it has been moved and seconded that the RAC accept the state elk management plan as presented. Any comment or discussion on the motion? Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Nope. Okay, the motion passes unanimous. The next item on the agenda is number 7, Bucks Bowls, once-in-a-lifetime 2016 season date application timeline and R657-5 rule amendments. Again by Justin Shannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tonight I'm going to present the 2016 Bucks Bowls once-in-a-lifetime season dates, boundary changes, and rule changes. As I begin, I'm going to start off with some changes to the big game rule, which is R657-5. Our first change is to clarify areas that have special restrictions. In our big game guidebook and our proclamation, those types of things, we talk about restricted areas in Salt Lake County, one of which is south of I-80 and east of I-15, where you can only pursue buck deer and bull elk with archery equipment, and another where you can only use archery equipment in the township of Immigration Township for big game using archery equipment. And we've had that for a long time, but that's never been identified in our rule, and we just want to clarify and put it in there. So this isn't a change structurally moving forward. It's more some housekeeping items for us. Another change to the rule is increase the number of elk permits a person can obtain annually to 3. As we talked about in the last presentation, it used to be that you can take two cows or a bull and a cow, and now we'd like to increase that a little bit with the following conditions. One is that you can only have a maximum of 1 bull permit, which it really isn't a change from the last setup we had. And then also a maximum of 1 antlerless elk permit can be obtained through the public drawing, which again was similar to what we had last time. The difference is you could have a maximum of 2 antlerless permits that are obtained over the counter. So whether these are leftover permits, antlerless elk control, mitigation vouchers, those types of things, you can have a little bit more opportunity. We also wanted to define antlerless elk control permits. We've been implementing these again for a very long time, and as I went through the rule, it wasn't addressed. And so we wanted to define antlerless elk control permits as a hunter must first obtain a buck, bull, or once-in-a-lifetime permit, and then they may harvest an antlerless elk using the same weapon time during the same season dates within the areas of overlap between the boundaries of their buck, bull, once-in-a-lifetime permit and their antlerless elk control permit. And these permits are to be sold over the counter. Next, we'd like to define a private lands-only permit, and this will be new for Utah. But this permit would allow a person to take 1 antlerless elk on private lands using any weapon during the season dates and areas approved by the Wildlife Board. There'd be no boundary extensions or buffer zones applied to these permits, and these permits would be sold over-the-counter online. We'd also like to put in rule for the first time to allow general season muzzleloader bull elk hunters to harvest a cow or a bull elk with their muzzleloader permit, similar to the archery setup. And again, this may be recommended on units that are chronically over objective, where hunter crowding is an issue, and throwing more hunters on top of hunters may not get you the desired harvest. We'd also like to clarify doe, deer, and the pronghorn sections as well. We've been issuing 2 doe permits for a very long time in this agency, but it's never been defined anywhere, and so we want to do that in through this rule change, where it would allow a person to take 2 antlerless deer or pronghorn using the weapon type within the area and during the season specified on the permit. And then we had some other minor clarifications throughout the rule as well. If you'll remember, this summer we conducted a primitive weapons survey, and there was an informational that came through the racks. And as part of that, there were over 19,000 respondents. And this slide does not do that survey justice, but in one slide, here's kind of the take-home message. The majority of big game hunters did not support the use of crossbows during archery seasons, and they didn't support large caliber center fire rifles, and they didn't support smart guns or computerized targeting firearms. However, the majority of big game hunters did support electronic range finders that were attached to bows and scopes on muzzleloaders during muzzleloader seasons. So I hope this is a quick refresher. Again, it doesn't do it justice, but this is hopefully rewinds you a couple months to when this was presented. So based on these results from the survey, the division is recommending the following changes to the big game rule. The first would be to prohibit the use of computerized targeting firearms to hunt big game or smart guns. The second would be to allow magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders during the muzzleloader season. And then the third would be to allow the use of an electronic rangefinding device attached to a bow to take big game. Moving on to season dates, the next two slides for deer and elk, essentially what we did is we moved the hunts that all occurred on Saturday's openers this year, we moved them all 5 days back. And so your archery hunt would start August 20th, go through September 16th. Muzzleloaders, your 9-day season from September 28th to October 6th, and any weapon would be October 22nd through October 30th. For elk, same thing, same archery dates, although the spike bull hunt would end September 9th, and your archery any bull would end September 16th. Your any weapon hunt for your spike and any bull hunts is October 8th through October 20th, and muzzleloader hunts recommending November 2nd to the 10th. Next, I'd like to present some recommendations that are statewide in nature and then move to the individual regional recommendations. So we'd like to add 6 new limited entry muzzleloader deer units. If you remember, we proposed this last spring for the first time, and it's where we manage these general season units that have 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does. If they're exceeding that 20 buck per 100 doe threshold over a 3-year average, then we could attach a late season limited entry muzzleloader hunt to it that would occur November 2nd through the 10th and overlap with the muzzleloader elk hunt. And so these 6 new units that are exceeding 20 bucks per 100 does are the Fillmore, the Monroe, Boulder Caparowitz, Thousand Lake, South Slope Yellowstone, and then Wasatch Mountains East, which is your current Creek of Inequin unit. The other recommendation is we'd like to add a limited entry bull elk hunt that overlaps the general season spike elk hunt in early to mid-October on select units. So Bryce, this is the part we were getting to. We'd like to try these on the Box Elder Grouse Creek, the Ponsagant, the Fish Lake, South Slope Diamond Mountain, and West Desert Deep Creeks. And again, this is something that we would ease into this approach and evaluate. Just get feedback from the hunters, look at the impacts of it, and if it's something that we feel like is a good opportunity, we'd move forward with additional hunts. Moving on to regional recommendations, the southern region, they're recommending discontinuing the beaver nanny mountain goat hunt based on surveys and transplant efforts and aggressive hunts. That population has really got down to its objective. And then also, this last summer, the Wildlife Board recently approved hunt boundary changes to some deer unit plans in the southern region, in particular the Oak Creeks. And so as those hunt boundary changes have already been approved, but as you see them this next year, it's just a reminder that they may be different or that they will be different from what they were last year. Southeast region, we want to alter the elk and bighorn sheep boundary on the Henry Mountains to align with the deer boundary. Right now we have 3 different boundaries for the Henry Mountains, and so we want to consolidate and kind of make those into one. And in so doing with this change, we'd have to alter the spike elk and bighorn sheep boundaries on the South Santa Fe as well. For the northern region, we recommend adding an extended archery deer unit, the Cache Lake Town, to address some urban deer issues. We recommend reinstating the bighorn sheep hunt on the Pilot Mountain, and along with the Pilot Mountain, altering that boundary so the elk and bighorn sheep boundary are the same and extended a little bit. We want to expand the boundary of the Pilot Mountain pronghorn hunt and rename it Box Elder West. And in so doing, we change the Snowville boundary, which we'd have to alter as well to adjust for that boundary change. And then finally, we recommend eliminating the Grouse Creek limited entry archery elk hunt. For the central region, no changes are being recommended. And for the northeast region, we recommend discontinuing the youth late season any bull elk hunt. This is a hunt that's had really low hunter success, and so we want to do away with it and think of other opportunities. Also, we want to add a bighorn sheep hunt on the Wasatch Mountains of Iniquin Unit. And similar to what we did with the Wasatch bighorn sheep permit on Mount Timpanogos and Rock Canyon, in those areas, Mount Nebo, the sportsman permit holder may hunt this unit during even years, and the statewide conservation permit holder could hunt that unit during odd years. Some other things to be aware of. This isn't something that we're necessarily asking the Wildlife Board of the RACs to approve, but it's something to be conscious of. On our website, there's times where you can pull up a hunt boundary name, and the same name will have multiple hunts associated with it. And I think that's caused some confusion for our hunters. And so what we want to do is not necessarily change the boundaries, but change the name. So for elk, the Fillmore Oak Creek would now be Fillmore Oak Creek South, and the Centerfell South would just have Dirty Devil attached to the back end. For deer, the Wasatch Mountains of Iniquin Current Creek, we're going to rename Wasatch Mountains East. The Pavant and Oak Creek will be combined just simply to be called the Fillmore. And then 9 Mile Panguitch Lake Plateau for pronghorn, and then Chalk Creek Camas for mountain goat. We'll just have additional language on the back end to distinguish them from other existing hunts that share the same name but have a different boundary. So some key dates for consideration for 2016 is for the big game draw, dedicated hunter applicants, the lifetime license holders, that application period is January 28th through March 3rd. Just looking to purchase a preference point or a bonus point, that goes until March 17th, and the results will be posted by the end of May. And then we present this every year, but I think it's important. Our hunters with disabilities, we essentially provide either 5 days prior or 5 days after the hunt for those individuals, and then those season dates are listed on the screen. And that's all I really have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Justin. I'd like to go ahead and go to the public for any questions regarding the presentation by Justin. Mr. Burns, why don't you sit up front?
You mean the actual shape file?
Yeah.
I've got this. I can put a jump right in.
No, it was on your presentation. Maybe it's the one I'm looking at back there.
I think it's in the packet.
So some of my questions are about the boundary changes in Box Elder.
State your name, please.
Oh, Robert Burns. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, if you could get them. So, and it'll probably be a specifically for the local region to explain, but on the pronghorn, the Box Elder West now does not align with the elk and Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep boundaries, and I was curious why that was and if it would be acceptable to move them so they match. Also, the southern boundary of the Snowville pronghorn boundary is out in the mud flat. It doesn't follow a established road, which we have just barely to the north along the railroad tracks. And then the eastern boundary of the Snowville pronghorn units is described as the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake, which, as we know right now, is quite far east in areas that we have no trespassing because we don't want people out there to those islands. So if the shoreline changes, maybe we should change the boundary description now while we're doing it. So. The slide that's up right now is the Elk and Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep boundary. If we go to the next, how do you move down? this boundary for Box Elder West is actually 6 miles farther west of that boundary. I was wondering why it is there and why we couldn't have it line up with the other one.
Jim Christensen, UDWR, Box Elder Region. So with these boundaries, this pronghorn boundary follows the old Pilot Mountain boundary, and then the elk and the bighorn follow the old bighorn boundary. And I guess technically we could extend the pronghorn out, but we just followed the old.
Jim, I'm sure you know that right in that area, it's right in that area, east of Little Pigeon Mountain, there is habitat and water that's outside of this boundary. Is that correct?
Habitat and water for
pronghorn.
Yes.
And then on this Snowville boundary, it says the shoreline. I'm not sure exactly what the definition of shoreline is, but right now we know the water is way out to the west. So would it be more appropriate to maybe describe this as an elevation or a high water line?
Yeah, we did follow an elevation on that. But in definition, yeah, we could, instead of calling it the shoreline, just put what elevation we're at. We just called it that. If an antelope is out in there, it's basically all mud flat. So the chances of them being out there are slim. I wouldn't say it would never happen, but we could change the wording to just put the elevation.
Any other questions from the public?
My name is Kelly Hicks, and speaking on myself. On Rule 657.5, he mentioned that they're going to make clarify the Immigration Canyon more fully within the proclamation. And I would just say to Justin and anybody that's here, look at it in the future, but I think we need to make some type of language for the City Creek area as well, because it is contained, it's within Salt Lake County. And I can tell you right now, there are a lot of issues within City Creek. It's within the city boundaries. You can't discharge weapons there, but they do have specific rules within the City Creek. They've designed within the watershed people that you can archery hunt in certain areas. The issue becomes with the rifle people and the boundaries. And there's just really no way for people to stop people from going into that canyon. And there's a
This is the question period. Do you have a question?
Oh, I don't have a question. I guess this is just a comment.
Okay, we'll get to comments here in a second.
Fine.
Sorry.
All right.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, we'll move to the rack for questions for Justin.
It's not necessarily for Justin. I'd actually like Darren to give us a reason or an explanation on the Lake Town Extended Archery. You're on the south end of Bear Lake in Lake Town. Where do you want those deer to go? And it's mostly private, and I was just curious if you could give us a little bit of a history on that.
I'm not going to bend over. we've had some issues in Lake Town itself with deer and raspberries. They're not commercial operations. They're just residential things.
Darren, isn't this a late hunt?
Yeah, it's for the extended archery
so
season.
Would there
the
be
boundary is fairly tight. So
would there be mitigation on raspberries and hay?
Not unless, if they're in greenbelt and it's a commercial operation, there would be. In this case, it's not the case. And we're also talking about flowers and gardens and things like that. So if they can get the permission from the landowners and permission to shoot within 600 feet of a dwelling or something like that, then a person could conceivably take an animal that was causing them some heartburn. And so The boundary is fairly tight. It really just is that Lake Town area. We tried not to go up on the hill, and so it's really just to try to address some concerns that folks have there in Lake Town. They've had a couple of public meetings about it.
So more of a maybe a PR hunt than a
right. This is something we told them that was something that we could do for them to try to address some of their concerns, and so then we followed through and went ahead and did it.
Okay. So, thank you, Darren.
Yeah.
Any other questions from the RAC?
Yeah. On eliminating the Grouse Creek unit, the archery hunt, the reason for that?
Yeah. Jim, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it's my understanding it's a migration issue just when the elk are there, and they don't tend to be there early on in the season in the same densities as later on in the season. So it just didn't lend itself to a great hunt. Do you have anything to correct on that?
Now, Jim Christensen, DWR. Yeah, so we will, with the migrations, Justin got it, with the elk, we typically will start seeing the cows and calves come into the Grouse Creek Valley about first to the middle of September, and then the bulls will really start coming in about the middle of September and then through October. And so last year we didn't have any of the archery hunters be successful on that hunt, but every rifle and muzzleloader, including the CWMUs, were able to fill their bull tag, and so that's why we got rid of the archery hunt, but then started or proposing the mid-season rifle hunt.
Would you increase the tags in for the rifle? And
we'll probably keep the tags the same. We could look at doing a slight increase in permit numbers, but last year is when we really increased the number of tags. We'll just have to look at age objectives and the population of harvested bulls and then determine off that.
I have a question about the survey that was conducted. So I noticed that the magnification of muzzleloaders was greatly accepted as a good way to go. Did that survey break out, like, say, how many muzzleloader hunters actually voted or recommended that versus the main group?
It did. We broke it into those that hunted with archery, because as one of the questions was, I'm going to mess up the wording here, but it's essentially, what would you consider yourself, a archery hunter, muzzleloader hunter, rifle hunter, most often? And from there, we queried the answers. And I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was always, there was never anything conflicting, which is why we presented the results in as a whole, that this is what the public wanted. If you want, I can dig those up real quick. I don't have those off the top of my head, how archery and muzzleloader and them did it, but the trends were always the same. If all hunters wanted it, it was generally the same with those.
So I was just curious on the difference in percentage, because it was a large percentage that wanted the magnification.
Yeah.
Versus my inclination would be that if you just asked the muzzleloaders, it'd be closer to 50-50.
I can look that up real quick. I don't know off the top of my head. So maybe as we're having discussion, I could look it up.
57%.
Yeah. What was it?
57% for magnified optics.
Yeah. It was 57% in favor, and then 39% opposed. But I think he's asking, what if it was just the muzzleloaders that were asked? And that's what I don't know off the top of my head. Is that
yeah,
correct?
That's right.
Okay. Do you have that, Mike?
I do somewhere, but it might take a minute.
Okay. Maybe as the RAC's having a discussion, I can pull that up.
Any other questions from the RAC? Yeah. Russ and then Chris.
So, Justin, on these new limited entry deer hunts for the muzzleloader, mm-hmm. How many tags are you thinking about issuing approximately, and do they come out of the allocated number of tags for that unit?
So last year we had 6 units, and of those 6, we issued 46 total limited entry permits. I think it ranged anywhere from 3 to 10 on a unit. So we're talking small amounts. And then as far as what allocation it comes out of, it's generally in addition to what, it's not like you're taking general season hunted, or general hunt, general season permits and converting them to limited entry. You're just adding limited entry permits to it. So thank you.
Justin, behind the proposal to add the magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders, is there any data from any other state that shows sort of a before and after regarding the lethality of the muzzleloader shot before scope and after? Maybe very difficult data to track, but, you know, I mean, I understand the everything behind it is increasing the lethality of the shot so that we don't leave wounded deer, you know, out there. So are there any other states that have had this experience and tracked before and after data?
Not that I was able to find. We did look at other states. Where's Rick at? Is he here? Rick, did we look at anything that dealt with scopes on muzzleloaders? Any other state have any data that said it's more lethal versus less lethal? I don't recall any as either. So it's a good question. I don't know if that's been quantified, though.
On the same topic, is there any reason why DWR is proposing that muzzleloader scope other than public support during the survey?
It's interesting to be in this position to present recommendation, because there's oftentimes where the decisions you make as a RAC would have biological implications. And at that point, we point them out and say, well, this is what it would be. On this, it's a fairly social issue on how we want to harvest them, because the bulk of our general season permits, if we're harvesting bucks for deer anyways, and then as far as to use open sights, one power, just an entire magnification scope, I think it falls in the category of a pretty social issue. So I guess to answer your question, sorry, I did a lot of talking, I don't know if I answered it. The survey certainly drove a lot of that, because if we ask our hunters, the public hunters, what is it that you want, and we don't have a biological reason to go against it, we can certainly go with that.
Justin, I don't. All it shows is that it's got the whole survey, but it doesn't flesh it out. It just shows 57% in support.
I can dig.
Okay. So, yeah. I have one more question, still comment. I'd like to pick on Darren DuBois one more time, or one of the other biologists closer to the front of the room. I just know Darren, so I know most of you guys, but. And I guess my question to you, Darren, I'll start before you get here, is to the magnified scope on a muzzleloader. So could it potentially, if it increases harvest because it makes us more efficient killers with a primitive weapon, could it affect opportunity, is my question to you.
Yeah, I think Justin started touching on that. We'll manage to the management plan for mule deer, and that plan calls for a buck-to-doe ratio. And so if scopes on muzzleloaders results in an increased success rate, that would result in a permit decrease,
right? Which would ultimately reduce opportunity.
Right. Yep.
Thank you, Darren. Appreciate it.
Any other questions from the RAC? Craig?
Okay, I got a couple of emails, and probably everybody got them. And I thought they probably ought to be up and talked about. The first one was on the management deer for bonus points for youth. And the email kind of stated that if a youth was born before July 31st, when he became 17, he would only have 3 points, or if he was born after July 31st, he would have four bonus points. And those that have 4 bonus points actually get 50% of the tags that are allotted to that hunt. And I just wondered if that's the way it is, and if that's, you know, if we need to look at making that more equal.
I'm sorry, Craig, I missed. I apologize. I'm so sorry. I cannot multitask to save my life. I'm here.
Okay. On the management deer hunts for youth, when the youth apply, if they're born before July 31st, when they turn 17, they have 3 bonus points, and if they're born after July 31st, they have 4 bonus points. Right. And those with 4 bonus points get 50% of the tags. So it seemed like a little bit unfair. And so I just thought that ought to be brought up, and if that's what it is, maybe something should be done to correct that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I saw the emails as well. Maybe I missed it. What was the question on it, though?
Well,
do you just want me to speak to it, or was there...
Well, it might be more of a comment section, I don't know, but he had a couple of solutions. One was to just the maximum points you could get was 3, mm-hmm. even if you were... You know, when you were 17, you'd have 3 bonus points,
yeah.
so that everybody would get 50%, have a chance to 50%, or else just not have bonus points at all.
It certainly isn't fair in the sense that you're right. Depend on where you were born, with the whole definition of youth. In some cases, hunters can have 4 bonus points; other hunters can have 3. Restricting it to just say everybody can have 3 may not be the solution because if you never draw one of those youth tags, those bonus points are still bonus points. You can put in for elk later on down the road when you're 18, 19, 20. So I'd hate to cap that and say you can't obtain a bonus point this year. I don't know if that's the answer.
So they go past
the
17-year. Okay.
Yeah, it's just like a limited entry bonus point that you and I would draw. So even if you don't draw that youth permit, you're not out. You still get limited entry hunting opportunities down the road for the max points. But you're right. I mean, the email that went out, there is a discrepancy there. There are some youth that get 4. There are some youth that get 3. We decided on the definition of youth to be that July 31st deadline. And there's some good reasons there. There's no hunts going on in the sense that upland game, big game, all those types of things. There's some pursuit of cougar, some of that stuff. But for the most part, that was the period where these... You weren't saying you're a youth before or after, right smack in the middle of a hunt. But yeah, it's not completely fair. It's arbitrary, but I don't know of a better arbitrary date.
Well, maybe you shouldn't give 50% of the tags to the 4 bonus points. Maybe you ought to take that out.
Maybe not have a bonus point, a max points for the youth. Just say everybody has the fair shake, whether you have 3 or 4, you don't issue 50%. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm just saying that the ones with 4 shouldn't get 50% of the tags. Maybe you should not do that. Make that a lower percentage or something to make
certainly
it
certainly something for us to look at, yeah.
The other email I received was concerning the limited entry muzzleloader hunts that you proposed. And there was an email, and the data they had in the email didn't support 3 hunts, the Fillmore, the South Slope Yellowstone, and also the Wasatch Mountain East. So I don't know if you probably want to look at your email to see if that matches. But anyway, his data did not support having those 3 hunts.
Was that...
He's saying that the gentleman that sent the email is suggesting that the numbers, that you're not over-objective, if I'm correct, right?
He's saying...
And they wouldn't qualify for the late... muzzleloader hunt that had to be at or over objective to fall within the parameters of this hunt structure.
Yeah, I think I know which one you're talking about. And the issue, if we're talking about the same email, they didn't include the 2014 buck to doe ratios. And we had spikes all over, spikes isn't the right word when you're talking about bucks. We had increases in buck to doe ratios in many of our units. And so the 6 units that I presented tonight, the 3-year average is exceeding 20 bucks per 100 does.
Thank you.
If not, we wouldn't have proposed it because that's the threshold you have to be in order to present.
So his data wasn't the most current data then?
It's just a year behind was
year
all.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Matt, did you have a question?
I did on the previous comment on the youth hunts. The July 31st, 17 or younger is pretty uniform across all of the different types of hunting. The question I had was why there's a date discrepancy that they have to be 14 by December 31st. You know, if that date was July 31st, then everybody would have the same opportunity, just a year jogged.
Yeah.
What was the rationale for those 2 dates being different?
So it's a great question. The December 31st date is set in statute, so it's not something that the RACs or board can change. It's a legislative thing. And essentially what that's saying is if you're going to be, if you're 13 years old after December 31st, but you're going to be turning 14, you can still apply for limited entry permits. That's what that date is saying. It's when can you start applying for limited entry. So that date has importance for the front end of this. When can a youth start applying for limited entry? The date of July 31st is the back end, because some 17-year-olds turning 18 years old, depending on where they fall, that's where you can get 3 points or 4 points. So I should have clarified that. It's a great point. I do have the data on the earlier question on how many muzzleloader hunters supported the scopes on muzzleloaders. Let me find that real quick, Bruce. I got it. So for that, it was 59% said they wanted magnification scopes, 40% said no, 1% had no opinion.
And you had no clarification on the degree of magnification within the question, correct? It was just one power or more than one power?
Yeah, we didn't get in the weeds in it. This first survey was just lots of different issues, and so where did we have some support? And then from there, we could start having these types of conversations. But, yeah, we didn't put restrictions on the magnification power.
The kids in Utah can hunt at 12?
General season, yes.
Yeah, why can't they put in for youth tags or these management tags? Limited entry, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, they can put in for limited entry when they're 13 years old, turning 14 in that year. So there's just a two-year discrepancy on general season can start at 12. The limited entry, it's just a...
Why have that discrepancy? I mean, we're going to let the kids hunt at 12, why can't we let them hunt everything at 12?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know.
Is that that's not a legislative, that's a division rule, right?
I think that would fall more under our division rules. But I don't have a good answer on that. Does any division employees have a good answer on that? Chad, you're laughing. You went, come on. I don't know, Bryce. I can find out and get back with you.
I think that's to give our kids a little bit more opportunity. I think it's ridiculous that 2 years they can't put in for anything. So I think we maybe look at that.
Bryce, I'll follow up with you on that because I don't have a good answer to that.
Bryce, my memory is that the Wildlife Board made that rule change to not allow 12-year-olds into the limited entry system until they were 14. That's what my memory tells me.
So the board may have some authority to move that December, July thing so that everybody has the same shot? Or is that statutory, you're saying?
So to clarify, the board doesn't have the ability to change the December 31st date. They do have the ability to change the July 31st date. But I guess my point with that is, no matter where you put that date, there's still going to be people born before and after that. And so we wanted to put that date in a place where no hunts were going. And starting in 2013, we started changing all of our big game, all of our rules, big game, waterfowl tonight, upland game, all those, so they can standardize it. Because before this, the definition of youth in the division was all over the place, and it was really frustrating our hunters where you could be a youth in upland game but not waterfowl, but you were still a youth in big game but not cougar bear. You know, so it was just we had to get some standardization to that, and that's why it landed where it did.
Any additional questions from the rack?
Yep. John. So the youth elk hunt, the youth can apply for that. I think there's a rule that says if they're 17 before the end of December. Is that right?
Say that again. So the for the youth
any bull hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Until they're, if they're 18... If they're 17 until the end of the year, then they can still put in for that. My question is there a reason why we don't have bonus points for those youth for the three or four years that they're able to put in for that?
So for the youth bull hunts, the youth, it's pretty unique. They can put in for a limited entry elk hunt, But then their pool of points for the youth any bull hunt is a different one. It's not a limited entry hunt. So they can put in for a Wasatch limited entry elk hunt and a youth.
And the youth.
And so if they don't ever draw as a youth, they still have these points here. So it's not a true bonus point, but it's tied specifically to that because it's an any bull hunt. So it's not a bonus point.
That was the concern I've been hearing is people complaining because their kids have wasted 4 years of no bonus points. So that's not true.
Well, I would have them put in for both because they can. So
yeah. I don't think they really understand that they could.
Yeah.
Additional questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move to the public for comment. And remember, if you would like to make a comment on this particular agenda item, we do need you to fill out a blue card and pass it to the front. As another reminder, you'll have 3 minutes if you represent yourself, and if you represent an organized group, you'll get 5 minutes, and Bryce will time you. We'll start with Troy Justinson.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. We support the division's recommendations from Bucks and Bulls with the exception of the muzzleloader and the magnification. SFW has decided to stand neutral in this. We had a long, lengthy discussion amongst our chapters and our members, and it's actually pretty heated and pretty divided. And so as an organization, we decided to stay neutral and encourage our individual members to come and voice their opinion on what they felt. And so we'll do that. To speak on that on a personal note, I personally don't believe you're going to kill more deer, but you are going to have more deer in the back of your trucks, meaning that guys, whether they have magnification or open sights, they're still going to shoot. What it is going to allow them to do to be more accurate where they shoot and recover more animals. And so don't kid yourselves. Today's muzzleloaders are not primitive weapons. They're single-shot rifles, basically matching that of a .308. Our bows are now muzzleloaders, so that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Next I have Steve Sorensen.
Steve Sorensen, I'd like to talk, I'd like to talk about this after Brett Wurston goes.
Brett.
Thanks, Steve. We were hoping that Chad would be here tonight and he could help tell what's kind of our story and what's happening as our sheriff for Cache County. I'm here as a lessee, representing the lessee that's charged with doing security for the Kohler Family Trust in Cornish, Utah. They have approximately 5,200 acres in Cornish. And I had emailed each of you my letter and then some maps earlier today. We have had, with this new Cache West extended archery, an unbelievable amount of trespassing issues. The entire trust or property that is owned by the Kohler family is all posted, it's cultivated, planted, and just a complete and blatant disregard for anything. And you talk to the people and they say just because the division has, you know, created this hunt, they feel like that they can go anywhere they want. We've had people drive across newly planted grain fields. It's really a frustrating thing from a landowner's perspective and for somebody who's doing security that we have no repercussion. And there's been such an overwhelming amount of trespassing issues that our sheriff and our division have not been able to respond to help us as well. And so we are proposing and have worked with and talked to Darren and to Justin both and proposed that we create a new boundary, which would be State Road 142, and that would be the southern boundary of the Kohler Family Trust property and have everything to the south be included. This hunt was, as we understand it, created to curb an urban deer population in Clarkston and Newton, and we're not close. We're probably 4 to 5 miles from either of those towns, Clarkston being the closest one. And so we would hope that you would consider making that those changes to that boundary on the Cache West extended archery hunt. Thank you.
Okay. Steve. One other.
Is there anyone that might have any questions about some of our concerns with that?
How much of that boundary change would include land that you don't
so
own?
So as I look at it, and if you look at that map, probably 40% of the lands in that Cache West extended archery hunt is the Kohler Family Trust land. What we're proposing would probably reduce the size of that unit by 50%, close to 50%.
Does the private landowners receive payment for damages?
So that's another challenge is we do have, some property that there's as many as three landowners that people are having to come across. And that's the frustration from the bow hunter's perspective is they will not give them permission to trespass adjacent landowners. And so I think that that's a frustrating thing for, some of those bow hunters is that other landowners won't give them permission as well.
So is the private landowners receiving payment from DWR for damages caused by wildlife?
I do not believe.
Crops?
You'd have to ask Darren that. We would propose and we would like to see landowners given mitigation tags and allow, those kinds of things to help that.
Yeah, we work with commercial operators on depredation, so they do receive tags or payment for damages. The bulk of our private land depredation concerns are probably around Cornish at this time, but there is a mechanism for that as well. Yeah, this, as Brett mentioned, was a hunt set up primarily to address, similar to the Lake Town hunt, concerns in Newton about deer coming into town, eating gardens, that kind of thing. This allows people to go around the outskirts of town. And so, we'd support this change. It still addresses the concern that we had at the heart of this. There's probably not a biological or a management reason to include that northern portion. So I have a map here, but it sounds like you guys have a shape file of that. So, okay.
Brett, so the proposal that you're making is that you move the boundary onto State Road 142?
Correct.
And that would be then the southern boundary for that unit.
That would be the northern boundary for the unit, but that's on our southern boundary, which would help. It wouldn't include any of our land.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Brett.
Just looking at the map that I have on both, I guess that'd be on both east and west. Is that also private property there as well?
That the entire unit is 100% private. There's not any public lands anywhere in this unit.
Okay, Steve Sorensen.
I'm Steve Sorensen. I'm representing the northern chapter of SFW, and I'm speaking in behalf of our parent company or organization also. We support the lessee of the Kohler Family Trust in changing these boundaries of this West Cache Extended Archery Unit. We support this change in the fact that it's 100% ag land around where they're trying to access these deer and that they shouldn't have to deal with these trespassers. Thank you.
Thank you. Neil Schaefer. Okay. Okay. Luann.
Okay, I'm Luann Schaefer, and I am the trustee for the Evan Kohler Revocable Living Trust, the land that that Brett Worsted has presented. It has been horrendous. The trespassing on our ground is horrible. And it's farm ground, and it's side hills. We farm side hills. And so these people are going up and down our side hills because they don't want to carry their deer out. They would rather take it out on their four-wheelers or in a pickup. And so we have potential roads that are going straight up and down our side hills, which are going to be washes and gullies come next springtime, which is, for a landowner, it's extensive repair work. It's a lot of money. Our road that goes up onto our ground runs right past my dad's house into our yard. We have trespassers that come right through there. It's posted. And when they're stopped and we say, "This is posted, what are you doing here?" Well, it's a road. It's public. It shows on Google Earth. It's on the maps that the hunting units show that we can hunt. It has been really bad. Since this extended archery hunt, it has been a nightmare. We spend countless hours, morning and nights, patrolling our own ground. We have posted everything, whether it's cultivated or not, because these people don't understand the word cultivated. Most of them are from the Wasatch Front, and they see that because there's a tag for this area, then it's okay for them to come up there and hunt on this private land. In that letter that I wrote, I cited a website stating that it says this private land is great for hunting. There was another website that said, because this is private land, the hunting there is phenomenal. Either the DWR needs to do a better job at educating these people that private land requires permission, and they need to have a permission slip on their person, not that somebody gave them permission 7 or 8 years ago. Anyway, that's all I've got to say, other than please make the boundary change, because it has been so bad for us. In fact, we're going to have to put up a gate in front of our house so these people do not keep driving through it, because it is not private land. I mean, it is private land. It's not a public road.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Any other comments regarding this particular agenda item from the public? Mr. Burns, do we have a comment card for you? I remember you had two on there. Okay, go ahead.
6-7.
Yes, I got you.
So I would just ask, in your recommendation to the Wildlife Board, that you adjust the Box Elder West East boundary to match the boundary that you see here for Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep and elk. So right along the west or the east boundary of this, it would match this boundary right here. That would include some pronghorn habitat and water resources that are available to pronghorn east of Little Pigeon Mountain.
Can you restate your proposal?
Adjust the east boundary of the Box Elder West pronghorn unit to match the Box Elder Pilot Mountain elk and Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep boundary.
Are you done with your comment?
No. I'll also ask you to adjust the south boundary of the Box Elder Snowbill pronghorn unit. Align that boundary with the road paralleling the UP tracks. It's a definable boundary. Right now, as described, it's a township or a range line going out through the mudflat. It's very hard for people to figure out where that is. Also, the east boundary of that unit is described as the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake. That should be described as an elevation or a high water mark. There are several islands in that area that probably starting to be exposed or exposed now that are posted no trespassing. So we try to keep people out of there. So just as long as people can read the boundary and it says, okay, I shouldn't be going past where this shoreline would be, then there won't be any issues there. There's probably not any pronghorn wandering out in the mud flats, but there might be. Also on the muzzleloader, modern muzzleloaders, my opinion, they're not a primitive weapon anymore, but I've always been of the opinion that we don't need magnifying scopes on primitive weapons. So I would be opposed to changing that language in the rule as proposed. Question?
If go back to your the first antelope, the one you want to change.
The Box Elder West, right there.
But that if you align that with the elk and the sheep, that boundary goes into Nevada. So you can't do that, right? You can't align those.
Let's look. Just the east boundary of the Box Elder West should align with the east boundary of... This east boundary right here, if you look behind you, this east boundary right here would move over 6 miles. It would go right up through there.
Okay, so that's you just want to add six approximately.
Yeah, it's one township over.
Okay.
Probably one of the biggest pronghorn I've ever seen was there, but I'll probably never draw that tag. So we're talking about to parallel, it would be this boundary right here.
Thank you. Thank you, Robert. Any other comments? Okay.
This is Steve Sorensen, SFW. Just want to clarify one thing. Everybody brought up ag land. Nobody said it. It's against the law to trespass on any ag land in the state of Utah unless you have written permission. So I know some of you know that, some of you may not. I just want to clarify that on that issue. Thank you.
Okay, we'll go ahead and move to the rack for comments.
I guess the only comment I would have is, I'd probably be the first guy in line to buy a magnified scope to put on a muzzleloader when it was legal. I guess my comment is, where do we draw the line on what we call a hunt that was designed to be a primitive weapon hunt, which I agree with Troy, it's no longer that, but it was to provide opportunity and allow people less pressure and a time to go out and maybe not see a bunch of guys. I think we're encouraging people, and I know we're not everybody's moral compass, but I think we're encouraging people to take longer shots and potentially wound more deer. If we chose to, or if it's voted upon that we go with magnified scopes, I'd put a limitation on it. I wouldn't allow it to be a 3x9 with turrets. I would recommend a 4-power to help those that can't see. I think maybe we can have the best of both worlds if that's what people truly want. 57% do. So that's just my only comment.
Other comments? Matt?
I would second that line of thinking. I mean, I think having the 1-power scope is actually a disadvantage for a lot of people right now. We heard at the last meeting there are some issues with obtaining disability CORs, how much of a problem that is. I think if we did a 4-power, fixed power scope, that would mitigate a lot of those problems, but not open up Pandora's box of any of these $2,000 scopes on these inline muzzleloaders.
Like Troy brought up, he said that, there might not be more dead deer. There might be more deer in the back of trucks. I agree with that, but guys that are shooting 200 yards now with open sights all of a sudden are going to be shooting 500 yards with a scope. So I think you're just going to compound the problem. I mean, I've heard plenty of guys shooting 500 yards with scopes, Best of the West already sells a muzzleloader that's, those guys are killing animals with them that are just ridiculously far. So I think we just keep pushing the envelope, and I don't know, if it was up to me, I'd say we leave it the way it is.
John?
My comment to that is I see a lot of guys trying to shoot their bows 70, 80, 90 yards, and I think it's just the nature of the beast. I personally think that if someone with eyes who are getting to be like mine are, and I hate to admit that, I see no reason why having the scope on a muzzleloader should be any bigger of an issue than having a compound bow that instead of a recurve made out of wood with wooden arrows. So I think if we're going to go down that track, we better go back to saying muzzleloader hunt can only be with a cap and ball. Otherwise, I think we need to accommodate people, let them have the opportunities that they desire to have. It's no different than the people that are trespassing. There's getting to be a lot more sportsmen who are mean-spirited about trespassing. I very seldom go to my property, which is not near as big as these folks' property, that I don't have my pistol on my hip, because they get really mean when you tell them that they can't be there. I would not approach a hunter who is trespassing without my handgun. So I admire these folks for going and chasing them off. I don't know if I would. I don't know if I would. And that's why I relate back to the muzzleloader thing. I think people are going to take those shots and do those things, whether they can shoot 50 yards or 500 yards. So I think the muzzleloader issue is a good issue in as far as being able to harvest the animal and take the animal.
Bruce?
So I agree 100% that those of us with failing eyesight need to be able to have a scope. And I would agree with the current regulation, which is a one power. Having used those enable us to adjust to our eyesight, and it makes it a tremendous ability for us to be able to look out there with a one power scope and see that animal at a decent range. What I disagree is that issue relates anything to the multi-powered scope, because the one power does what a muzzleloader hunter needs, that is, having failing eyesight. It enables them to see that animal through a focusable one power scope. And then I also would suggest, before DWR jumps at, excuse me, before this regulation is changed, that we probably look at that statistic, because I've talked to many people and they didn't actually know they could put a scope on their muzzleloader, a one power scope on their muzzleloader. So I would just recommend that perhaps that question didn't clarify to a lot of people that they already could put a scope, and maybe a lot of the yeses were, yeah, I'd like to put a scope on muzzleloader. And if they knew that it was just one power, the statistic there would have been a lot different.
Any other?
I'm not an ophthalmologist or don't know a lot about specialists on optics, but my understanding is the one power scope is actually basically the glass with the crosshair. You really have no magnification whatsoever. I don't know that it really would benefit someone with failing eyesight. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Having used those, you're right. They don't magnify one at all, but it makes a tremendous difference on what you can see. So it makes a big difference for someone who has failing eyesight. They can put that one power scope on there and see so much better than just an open.
Any other comments?
Just one other one back to the boundaries with his family. I would hope as a comment that when these, with the division, or when we're looking at doing these type of hunts, that we would take into consideration the public ground, our private ground, and what it is. It seemed a little bit foolish to even include that in there. I don't know the reason behind it, but hopefully when we look at urban hunts or look at these things, we look for who the landowners are and if there's any benefit to it, because there didn't seem to be any.
Any other comments before we get to the motion? Before we do take a motion, I'd like to recommend to the RAC that we have several rather complicated pieces to this particular agenda item. So it might be helpful if, when you make a motion, if you have a particular motion or an item within that big chunk, that we separate those out. And so there's no reason why we can't handle multiple motions for this particular agenda item. Does that make sense? So if we want to cross the muzzleloader scope issue first. We could do that. Somebody can make, yeah, separate it out. Somebody can make a motion regarding that. And then the remainder, we can just accept as presented. Okay. So we will entertain a motion at this point.
So with your direction, I would like to make a simple motion. That is, we remove the recommendation to allow magnified scopes on muzzleloaders from the bigger recommendation.
Okay. So to clarify, you were suggesting that we remove even the one power.
No, because okay. That's existing regulation.
Okay. So the motion is to eliminate from the material presented tonight the scope addition.
Scope magnification addition.
Okay. We have a second. Okay. Second. So we have a motion and a second to remove the magnification proposal that was presented with tonight's agenda item. Do we have any discussion on that item? Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye, and raise your hand.
Aye.
Aye.
We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in favor. Opposed?
Aye.
1, 2, 3, 4. 5 opposed. So the motion passes. For those of you that voted in opposition, could you please just briefly make a comment for the minutes as to your reason?
Our sportsmen spoke. We sent out a survey, and 57% wanted optics on their muzzleloaders. And I represent sportsmen. I was trying to find a happy medium with the four power that I could meet their needs, and maybe not create a bigger problem with higher-powered scopes.
I would second what he said. I agree. I think a four-power is what I would like to see.
Okay, so the rest of the RAC also agreed with that same comment. Okay. Any other motions associated with this agenda item? Matt.
Excuse me, I would make a motion to amend the West Cache urban deer boundary as proposed. It sounds like nobody on the south end of this is allowing hunter access anyway.
Okay, so you're speaking on the Cache West extended archery hunt boundary and moving that boundary so that we are looking at a new boundary on State Road 142.
Correct. Okay.
Do we have a second?
I second that motion.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion on that? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Motion carries. It's unanimous. Next, anyone else?
I would like to address Robert's Rules of Order, or whatever that's called.
Oh, good luck. Good luck with this one.
What he said, how's that? I don't know.
I'm not sure I can even summarize what he said. I tried to write fast, but it wasn't going. So can we just use... Jody, do you have it all? Robert... Can you come forward, please?
Anyway, my motion is that we move those boundaries to where Robert recommended that they be.
All right. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, and maybe go with the high water mark, not an elevation. High water mark's a lot easier than the elevation.
But it's the Great Salt Lake.
It's pretty well defined, the high water mark there.
You have to make sure the minutes or the motion reflects what I say, I'm afraid. So.
Yeah, I am too. Okay.
Adjust the box elder west pronghorn unit boundary on the east to match the box elder Pilot Mountain elk and Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep unit east boundary.
Okay.
Adjust the box elder Snowville pronghorn unit boundary south, the south part of that boundary, to align with the road on the UP tracks. Adjust that same unit boundary on the east where it says north along shoreline to Locomotive Springs to reflect a high water mark or elevation if required.
Okay, so that's the motion by John. Do we have a second? Second by Matt. Discussion on the motion. Okay, all in favor of those boundary changes, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Okay, it's unanimous. The motion passes. Anything else associated that we want to pull out of this particular agenda item? If not, then we could entertain a motion to approve the remainder as presented.
I would so move that we approve the rest of the forward recommendation on the rest of the
Do we have a second? Okay, a second from John. So the motion is to accept the remainder of the presentation as presented. Any discussion? Okay, all in favor, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Okay, the motion is unanimous. Okay, if there is no objection, we will recess for 10 minutes. Seeing no objection, we will recess for 10 minutes.
I think Robert should bring it in writing the next time.
I'm glad Robert.
We're missing John. He's hobbling up. Okay. John and Justin. Okay, where's Justin? Let's go ahead and get started. The next business item in order is the Southeastern Region Deer Management Plan, and that'll be presented by Guy Wallace from the Southeastern Region. He's the Wildlife Manager.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to be presenting our mule deer management plans that we're going to revise for this round. It's not all of our plans. It's most of them in our region, and it also includes the Manti, which is part of the central region as well. As most of you know, there was a statewide mule deer plan that was approved in December of 2014. It provided direction for our deer management over the next 5 years. It set the sideboards for our unit management plans, and it also kind of timed so that when we do the range trend evaluation, that we can revise these plans after that once we have that data from the range trend evaluations to use in the development of our unit management plan. The goals in the statewide plan, which you may have seen before, the guidelines were basically that we would manage for a healthy population of animals. We would maintain the levels with long-term capacity of the habitat, and we would try and improve and protect our habitat. our strategies, the plans would follow kind of the statewide plans, broken down into monitoring section, how we will monitor the populations, and also limiting factors for each of the units. If any of these factors apply to those units, we hope to try and address those factors in our unit management plan. It also had habitat strategies in the plans, monitoring strategies, protection of habitat, and also improvements of habitat. These are the plans that in our region we will be, we are revised. The Central Mountains, Manti San Rafael, the La Salle Mountains, the Abajo Mountains, and the Nebo part of the Central Mountains, which is the central region, the Dolores Triangle, Elk Ridge, and the Henry Mountains. The Dolores Triangle, I may have something in there later, but the range trend has not been complete, or well, it was completed this summer, but we don't have the results for the Dolores Triangle. But we only manage a portion of that deer herd. It's a Colorado deer herd, and we basically manage the winter range. And if there's information that comes out of that range trend data, then we would probably ask for an amendment to our LaSalle plan next year. We were directed by the board to look at options for splitting the Manti unit. There was some conversations and some recommendations to look at a split on the Manti unit and how it would affect the buck-doe ratio on that unit. We held 4 open houses in our region, scattered out throughout the region, trying to gather input on the boundary question, also on our management goals for the Manti unit, the objectives for the unit, and the strategies for the deer population. They were well advertised, however, they were not very well attended, our open houses. And I guess my interpretation of that would be, and Troy may correct me on this later, that our hunters are in our region are all real happy. And I may eat my words at the RAC meetings down there. Basically, what I did was kind of summarize the comments that we did receive at the open houses into what the main points were of the groups that did attend the meetings on each of these particular units. As you can see, the Central Mountains, Manti, the big issues were population, older age class bucks, and increasing the buck-doe ratio, and then also this issue of splitting the unit with some comments that we received on that. The La Salles, the San Juan, and both the Abajos and Elk Ridge, most of the comments, there was comments on increasing population, but a lot of the comments were on predation, on bear predation, lion predation. We have healthy bear and lion populations on those units, and so that has always been an issue with those units. And then the Henry Mountains, we really didn't receive many comments, and they were primarily about not wanting any additional permits on the Henry Mountains, not so much crowding. I lumped that into crowding, but it was more not having additional permits on the Henry Mountains. We also, to help get at this question of splitting the units, we sent out an email survey to all or to hunters that had a Manti permit in 2014. We sent out 10,000 surveys, and we received 2,600 responses back. It's about 25% response on that. And I kind of just pulled out the questions with the units, or what units they hunted split out. That's why it's in 3 different bar graphs there. They were combined. We asked the question if they felt like deer populations were decreasing, and there, a lot of hunters did feel like deer populations were decreasing on the Manti, and it was kind of split out more so on the south than on the north, that they felt like deer numbers were less. The north tended to be more even, that hunters felt like the population was either stable or increasing. But this on this particular graph, it shows that We ask of those hunters that hunted the manti, in which section of the manti they hunted, would they want to split the manti into a north-south unit? And the majority said that no, they did not want to split the unit into a north-south unit. On the San Rafael unit has been included as a part of the manti, and there was also some discussion on whether we should split out the San Rafael and make a special or a separate unit for that. Although this graph shows, it appears to show that there were less manti hunters that wanted it to be a separate unit. It actually was slightly more when you combine those. However, most of the people that hunted the San Rafael unit did not want it split from the manti unit. And then also when they were asked, if the units were split, which unit would you select? Most of the San Rafael hunters, 50% of the San Rafael hunters said they would not pick the San Rafael if it was split from the manti unit. We'll kind of start with the manti unit. This is where our recommendation and our management plans are. We recommend that we maintain the buck-doe ratio at the current level that we have it, and also going to maintain our population objective. This kind of gives you an idea of where we're at with our population objective and permit levels. We actually have less permits than what we had when it was before it went to unit by unit on that. This is where our buck-doe ratio sits. We're above objective on the manti unit. The three-year average is 19, and it's a 15 to 17 unit. And probably, most likely, that has to do with the less permits that we've had has allowed our buck numbers to increase there. Part of our recommendation to not change the buck-doe ratio on the manti unit was based on that it's a large public land unit. It's one of the most popular units. It is the most popular general season unit in terms of odds of drawing a permit for that unit. And by maintaining that at a 15 to 17 buck-doe ratio, it allows for additional hunting opportunity, especially where we're increasing buck numbers. A higher buck-doe ratio would reduce the odds of drawing a permit on that unit. Because eventually we'd have to decrease permits to maintain that buck-doe ratio. Another issue with that is that it is a CWD-positive unit, and by managing that unit for a higher buck-doe ratio, we actually increase the potential for CWD transmission. And on the other hand, having that as a CWD issue there, it lowers the life expectancy of these bucks, and so it would make it more difficult to maintain that high buck-doe ratio. The unit, the fawn production is pretty good on that unit, so there's not an issue with production. And as I said, as I showed you the graphs, the survey indicated that the majority does not want to split the unit north and south, that they did not want to split the San Rafael. The San Rafael hunters didn't want to split the San Rafael. There's some other additional problems with that split. Is that if we split it, we don't have a good boundary to create a good boundary for that, because Highway 10 splits the private land, and that would be an easy boundary. But it splits the agricultural areas, which would make it difficult to manage those areas. Those are areas part of the unit that we don't want to increase deer numbers because of the agricultural problems there. We would have to come up with some kind of a boundary out in the middle of the desert in order to split that unit off. The other thing is we don't collect data on the San Rafael by itself in terms of buck-doe ratio, so it'd be difficult to set an objective for that unit if we split it off, because we don't have the data to say what our buck-doe ratio should be or would be or what our population objective. One thing that we have recommended, and as I pointed out from the open house survey and from other, we had another meeting too with them, that the local concern was primarily with low deer numbers, but particularly on the southeast portion of the unit. And I think that's kind of what had initiated this reaction to want to split the unit. And so we felt a better way of addressing that concern was to use an approach where we try and increase numbers on that unit, and felt like splitting the unit or going to a higher buck-doe ratio only increases buck numbers and doesn't really do anything for population numbers, total population. And we felt like that there was some different strategies we could use to try and increase deer population. And one of those was to pursue transplants to portions of that unit that have chronic low numbers. We submitted some transplant sites. I think I have those on here. I'll switch to that in a second. We submitted those transplant sites through RDCC, and we received no comments. So now they can be included in the statewide transplant list. One of the experiences we've had, at least from transplants we've done on Elk Ridge, is that the deer tend to remain in the areas where you release them. And so where we're trying to increase populations in some of these areas with low numbers, it's more likely that those deer will stay there and hopefully survive. The other part of that was that currently on the north end of the Manti, the northeast end of the Manti, is where we're doing most of our telemetry studies. And so we want to expand those telemetry studies to the southeast portion of the unit to see if we can look at survival and if there's issues with deer survival on that portion of the unit. These are the transplant sites that we have submitted and which will be included in the statewide transplant list. It's basically kind of hard to tell from that map, but it's basically Huntington Canyon, if you're familiar with that, south along the Manti to Emory, well, all the way down to I-70. On the Nebo unit, there's really no changes on the Central Mountains Nebo unit. Everything's pretty much the same as far as that portion of the plan. This is information on our population estimate, permit numbers. And basically where the line goes flat is where we started by unit by unit. Our buck-doe ratio is slightly above objective for the last 3 years. Average, it's at 3, and you can see what's happened with that as well. The LaSalle Mountains, we're not recommending any changes on the LaSalle Mountains. Let me go to that next one. It's kind of bounced up and down. The population has been more stable on that unit. It has not had as high a fawn production on that unit. We actually decreased permits the first year after going unit by unit. We saw a pretty big dip in our, in our buck-doe ratio. And we adjusted permits that next year, and the buck-doe ratio came back up. So right now we're at 14, which is slightly below, but it's only been 2 years. The harvest or the classification data that we get from this year's classification will give us that third year of data to see where we're sitting based on how many permits we have. This is the triangle portion. Everything's pretty much the same on the triangle as what we've had. The population there has basically declined. And as I said earlier, we have a winter range for that herd. It's the Glade Park deer herd in Colorado is where they summer. And that population has been declining, and we have had some issues on our winter range as well. And we actually decreased the population objective. You can see in 2012, I think. Because of that, basically we had an issue where A lot of those deer that were wintering on the Utah side came down into an area, agricultural area, and once that crops dried out or the grass dried out, they went to the winter ranges there, which was sagebrush, and just hammered the sagebrush. And that sagebrush eventually died in there, and we lost that. And so we decreased our population objective that year to make it, at least until we see things turn around in Colorado. The other thing, oh, I might go back to that. We're very conservative in our permits that we issue for the triangle, so we're not really affecting the deer herd management. We issue 20 permits, and as you can see, we've issued 20 permits for a long time in there, and it's just based on when the deer are there on the Utah side and trying to maintain a quality hunt on the Utah portion of that. As you can see, even with the deer numbers or with the deer numbers declining, our buck doe ratio has been slightly below that. It has dipped below what the objective is. But like I said, we're probably not affecting that population with only 20 permits. And so if we decrease the permits, it wouldn't really do anything in terms of that herd population. So there's no change there. The Abajo Mountains, kind of the same story as the La Salles there. We've actually seen that population at one point reach the objective. We had, you know, a pretty severe winter in 2011. The deer population decreased, but it's shown signs that it's increasing again. As far as our buck doe ratio, we're at the top end of the 15 to 17 there. So it's doing pretty well, that unit. One of the units that we're proposing a change is in the San Juan Elk Ridge unit, and it's kind of a situation similar to the triangle in that we've had loss of a major winter range for that unit. The decrease there is from 7,000 to 5,600, which is a 20% decrease, and that's based on the winter range called Beef Basin is 20% of the winter range for that unit. And I think it's a fairly conservative reduction because when that unit or when that winter range was healthy and had forage available, it probably held more than 50% of the deer herd on that unit. So reducing that objective by 20% is a conservative reduction. And we're proposing as a short-term reduction, we're maintaining a long-term goal, but this is for the life of this plan, which is 5 years. We're not confident that we'd even, with the production rates we have there, we would even reach this 5,600. But we have done quite a bit of habitat work on that winter range. In fact, I probably ought to get to that. To try and bring that sagebrush back. This is kind of what's happening with the population on Elk Ridge. Again, it's a limited entry unit. We only have 50 permits and have had for quite a while. And we've been able to maintain our buck doe ratio even with those low numbers on that unit. Our range trend information that we have on that unit, the large red dots indicate very poor condition in the range trend. The area to the west of that unit with the two large orange and the red and the yellow, which are all either poor, very poor, or fair, is that Beef Basin winter range. This is kind of what's happened on that winter range over a long period of time. This has been a long process. There's a lot of factors that have influenced that. And it took a toll on it when we got into a drought period. So like I said, this is the area where we've done quite a bit of work with the sportsman's help in planting sagebrush back into there and trying to see if we can get that back into that winter range. The Henry Mountains unit has done really, really well. We feel like the population is increasing, and we're actually proposing an increase in the population objective for the Henry Mountains. This is our population estimate, and we've maintained those permits. The 78, it's actually, I think it's 48 because 30 of those are management tags, management buck tags. It shows what's happening with the buck doe ratio. The yellow line in there is a kind of an extra line I added, which that unit's also managed for a percent of bucks that are greater than 5 years old. And that's that yellow line. The objective for that is greater than 55%. And as you can see, we're above that. So in summary, these are the two units that we're proposing changes in our management plans, Elk Ridge and the Henry Mountains. And I didn't mention on the right side is the acres of habitat improvement projects that we've done on each of those units. And that's all I have.
Great. Thank you. Okay, we'd like to have any questions from the public regarding the Southeastern Region Deer Management Plan. Rack, any questions regarding the plan? Okay, we don't have any comments, cards from the public. If you'd like to comment, we can entertain that now. Rack, comments from the rack. And or motion.
I'll try it.
Okay.
I'll make a motion that we accept the management plan as presented.
With a second. Second from Craig. Okay, the motion and a second to accept the Southeastern Region Wildlife or Deer Management Plan as presented. All in favor, raise your hand and signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, unanimous. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next item of business is the CWMU management plans. Scott McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the division, and this evening I will be presenting the 2016 CWMU Buck and Bull recommendations. Just to maybe educate a few of the newer members of the RAC committee here, basically we receive three types of applications every year. We have new applications. A new application is obviously somebody that has never been in the program before, but it also may include significant property changes or property ownership changes also. And we have renewal applications. All of our CWMUs are on a three-year renewal plan. And so some of these tonight will be renewals. They're at the end of their 3 years. And then we have change applications. We allow CWMUs to make certain changes to their management plans or their permit numbers, and anything that has a change in a permit number or the allocation or the public-private split, the ratio, or any change in season dates needs to go through the RAC and the board process. So for this year, we received seven new applications for CWMU. Two of these were due to land ownership changes that were greater than 34%. Either an increase or a decrease in acreages. We had five brand new applications that had never been in the system before, and we have one of those applications of the seven that the division is recommending to deny. That would be the Blue Mountain Muleys, and I'll get into that later. We have 12 CWMUs that submitted renewal applications for a new three-year stint, and nine CWMUs have submitted change applications that require rack and board application, rack and board approval. Some of the applications that come in are just due to minor property changes and things like that, but we don't take those through this process. We had four of the CWMUs that were enrolled in 2015 that did not apply for 2016. So we have a total of 28 applications that were submitted for this year, for next year, excuse me. Just as an overview, this is based on our recommendations of approval. If all were recommended as we approve, it would bring the number to 127 CWMUs statewide. And just a breakdown of how many are in the regions. Northern region would have 75 of those, definitely the bulk of them. Northeastern would have 7. Central would have 11. Southeastern region 20, and the southern region would have 14. There's over 2.26 million acres that are enrolled in the CWMU program right now, of which 96.8% of that is in private lands. We have about 605. There's give or take a few. Private landowners that participate in the CWA, currently participate in the CWMU program. So for 2016, this is the overall permit recommendations that we have. For buck deer, we're recommending 1,996 private permits and 264 public permits. Management buck deer, there's only one CWMU that qualifies for these, and that's the Alton CWMU. And we're recommending 2 private permits and 1 public permit. For bull elk, there's 943 private and 140 public. Buck pronghorn, 83 private, 62 public permits. And bull moose, 48 private and 30 public permits. For a total of 3,072 private permits that would go to the CWMUs, and 497 or 14% of those would go to the public through their draw. So I'll go briefly over the recommendations by region. We'll start with the northern region here. We had 3 new of them. One was a brand new one. 2 of them were due to changes in land ownership and acreage changes. The Georges Creek is a new one. It's a deer CWMU. And our rule requires that the division give a recommendation for approval or denial of these. And so the recommendation on the right-hand side there is just the division's recommendation. We go through the screening process on those, and we approve the recommend approval of all these, Rattlesnake Pass and Riverview Ranch. Those were just due to new ownership and acreage changes. So we had... These are the renewal applications. Like I say, these are the ones that are at the end of their 3 years and are renewing for 2016 through 2018. And there's the Bastion Ranch. The rule also requires that, or asks that we identify any changes. And so what I did is I went through for the major changes to the applications from their previous applications. Bastion Ranch, the main change on that is they changed the name, I'm not sure why, but they changed the name to Causey Spring CWMU. So that might blindside a few people, but the rest of these, one of the major changes on these, on Strawberry Ridge, they currently have a variance, an elk season variance that allows them to hunt past the published dates for CWMUs. What they have to do is demonstrate the need for this, and this has gone through the regional review, and they're requesting to, I think they had it till the 20th of November, and they're requesting that to go to the 30th to increase both public and private opportunity, and the division has recommended approval of that. But these are Bastion Ranch, Cotton Thomas, Junction Valley, Pine Canyon, Rabbit Creek, Strawberry Ridge, and White's Valley, and the division recommends approval of all those. Some change applications for the northern region. Deseret has requested some pretty significant, fairly significant permit number changes. They increased their deer and their elk permits. and they asked for a reduction in their pronghorn permits. And then the division recommends approval of that. On the Jacobs Creek CWMU, they requested changes in property boundaries. This has since been resolved. They've decided not to do any property boundary changes at this time until we can review it and come to a better agreement with the division on what those should do. Also, the Jacobs Creek representative is here tonight, and he's going to ask for a permit number change that came in after the fact, and so you'll be able to make a decision on that also. They did request an increase of 10 elk permits. They went from 10 to 20 elk permits with a total of 18 private and two. That's a 90-10 split, and the division is in agreement for that. Grass Valley Clark Canyon also asked for an elk season variance. They currently have one, I believe, till the 20th, and they asked for that to go to the 30th of November also, give more private to. A lot of this is to keep the elk up out of the agricultural areas and keep some hunting pressure on those, and also give a better opportunity for both public and private hunters. And the division is in agreement with that. So Park Valley is going to remove their deer from the CWMU. It'll be just a pronghorn CWMU. The southeastern region, moving on to that, Blackhawk is a brand new, it's a deer and elk. They're requesting to be a deer and elk CWMU, and they're requesting a variance in the elk season to go to November 30th. They really don't have many elk on the property, yet they winter a good portion of those elk in the wintertime in that whole general area, so they're asking for a variance for that. And the division recommends approval of that. JB Ranch is just a renewal. They change their operator and ask for an increase of elk permits. They qualify for that, so the division is in approval. Ask for approval of that too. Southeastern region change applications. I'm not going to go through each one of these, but Schofield East, Schofield Canyon, Summit Point, they all request for changes. Some of these are additional permits. The one that we have a split recommendation on is that the Schofield Canyon CWMU they increase their acreage by 120 acres. They're requested two additional bull elk permits, but it doesn't qualify for the permits. And this being that it is a limited entry unit, and they only qualify for a portion of those based on habitat or acreage, for what the comparative to what the CWMU is with the unit. So always when we get into the limited entry units, you have to remember that these come out of the public draw because there's only so many permits that are allocated for these units. So Deer Haven asked to remove elk from a CWMU, so it can be a little more in keeping with its name, Deer Haven. So, but they, I guess they've had a hard time harvesting elk on that unit and asked that to be dropped. So, Spring Creek Dodge is requesting additional bull elk permit, and they do qualify for that. So, we recommend approval of both those also. Southern region, we had one new application. This is an application that was proposed last year. There were some issues with public land that were included in it to make up minimum acreage and made it so it didn't qualify. They've since rectified that. It's 100% private land, so they do qualify for. We recommend approval of CWMU for a new CWMU also. Southern Region had two new renewal applications, Grazing Pasture and Johnson Mountain Ranch, and we recommend approval of those, and those would be the changes from the previous application. Central Region, we had two renewals. Chris's Creek, there were no changes from previous application. We recommend approval of that. And Heartland West, it's a new renewal, and they had a president operator change and some adjustment in their permits. We recommend approval of that. They do qualify for for additional permits, or a reduction in permits. Sorry, they did also did have a permit season change. They went from a September 11th to November 10th to a September 1st to October 31st season. Northeastern region, new applications. We had Blue Mountain Muleys. This is a new application. The division is recommending denial on the basis of kind of twofold. This one has got a very, very complicated boundary. We have a part in the CWMU rule that says that it may meet the technical requirements but not necessarily constitute a good CWMU. The operator that has applied for this also has some recent wildlife convictions and several investigations that have we felt that has rendered him not qualified to run the CWMU. So that's the reason that we're recommending denial on that. West Willow Creek Ranch, it's in the Buck Cliffs. It's a deer. I didn't include antelope or pronghorn on here. It is a deer and pronghorn. It's a new one. It meets all the requirements, and we recommend approval of that one also. With that, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions from the public regarding the presentation? Questions from the RAC on the presentation? Chris.
Scott, could you briefly describe the process you go through to get to approval or disapproval once you have an application for a new CWMU or a change application?
Okay, it's quite a process. And originally, it will go to the region who basically does the majority of the screening process. And what they have to look at is it meets all the requirements of the rule. It meets the minimum acreages. That the permits they're asking for, that they do qualify for, whether it's in a limited entry unit or a general season unit. They look at the landowners, they look at the properties. It's an extensive process of looking through court records, county recorder records, making sure that the properties are that are enrolled do qualify and that they are, in fact, owned by the people that are signing for them. It's hard to go through the entire process. It's about a 16-page application that we look at and approve.
What about the appropriateness of the permit numbers depending upon the game that's going to be harvested there?
That's absolutely taken in consideration. And like I say, if it's a limited entry unit, they all come from the same pool of permits. There's a limited number of permits in the draw. And so what we look at on those, there's a policy and a procedure that we go through to look at those, and basically if you look at the percentage of habitat with the percentage of property that's enrolled in the CWMU is actually the percentage we use that we'd qualify for them for. We can make adjustments due to increased use, to increased agricultural damage. There's other things that are taken into consideration, but basically it's a percentage of the habitat that's in the unit. And general season units, we just make sure that it's not an excessive amount that is exceeding the surrounding areas for hunting pressure.
Any other questions?
Yeah. What constitutes the ability of a CWMU to extend their dates to the 30th, or what are the...
For the elk season variants?
Yes.
The rule says that they need to clearly demonstrate the need to have it. And so what they do is they submit a letter that goes with the application demonstrating that need, and the region looks at that and says, yeah, that shows the need. I mean, they're the ones that approve that, basically. So,
why did all of them only request, I mean, a bulk of them requested an extra permit? What I could see was elk. It was only one. Everybody only requested one. Is that just to keep them under? I mean, if they were to go to two, that would kick in an extra public permit?
Not necessarily. A lot of the CWMUs, for example, if they have a 90-10 split and say they have six private permits and one public permit, A lot of it is in response to increased populations. They may only want to harvest because of their management plan, their internal management plan, and they're wanting to keep quality. They feel they can harvest one more bull. Once they reach that 10, the 11th one would go to the public. And so once in a while you have that, but generally it's in response to populations. So.
Any other questions? Yeah.
One of the units, I'm looking at my paper. I was just curious. They chose to go from the 90-10 or the 9-1 split to 8-2. That seems, I mean, that's good of them, but why? I'm just curious.
I think you're referring to the Heartland West. Mm-hmm. And what they did, I guess they did it out of the goodness of their heart because they didn't need to do that. They just offered another public permit, and that's their donation, basically. So they didn't need to do that. They could have gone with a 9-1, but they chose an 8-2. There's no advantage for it except for they just offered another one to the public. So
I was impressed with that. And I think things like that give a little better name to CWMUs, and it also makes you look closer when they come with some of these requests that they're willing to work with,
sure,
with the public and not just thinking about the dollar.
Yes, I agree with you.
Anyone else? Okay, let's turn to the public for comment. I have one comment card from Justin Richens.
My name is Justin Richens, and I represent the Jacobs Creek CWMU. And I had just come before the board tonight, or the RAC committee, excuse me, to ask that we rescind our deer on our unit. We've been working with the DWR and the UWC Wildlife Committee to come up with a boundary, because we do have some boundary issues on the north and south of the property that will work. But in the end, I believe we all felt like it was too rushed. And I think it would be in the benefit of the program, the CWMU program, because I feel like some of these issues are starting to create a black eye for the program and myself, that we pull our deer for the time being until we have enough time to evaluate it again and come up with a better boundary that works for the public and the private. So I'm asking you if we can pull our 2020 deer tags out of the unit for the time being.
Thank you. Anyone else care to comment regarding that agenda item? Okay, we'll go ahead and turn to the RAC for comments. And or motions. That's Jacobs Creek. And so, Scott, was that not in your presentation, the recommendations for the Jacobs Creek that he just made?
Yeah, originally that wasn't in the presentation. That just came in the last couple of days after this was already sent to the RAC and the board through the packets. And so he was advised, I said, you know, we can't change our recommendation right now, but you can approach the RAC and ask for it. And I guess I can speak for the area biologists. I visited with him, and we're in agreement that's an acceptable thing for them to drop the deer from the CWMU at this point. So that wasn't in the original recommendation. The original recommendation was to deny the land exchange that they had proposed on Forest Service lands. For the north end of the unit, there was two exchanges. They've withdrawn that request as of tonight to leave it the way it is. Their request for an additional 10 bull elk permits was the division's in agreement on that. And if he would like to drop the deer from it, we would be in agreement also.
Okay.
So.
Good.
You have another?
Yeah.
Just, I bring this up as I received a phone call from an acquaintance concerning some of the extensions of the hunt to the extra time. Would it be possible to increase the number of the permits without having to extend the date and put more pressure on the animals? We're hunting them from September 1st all the way till November 30th now. Could we accomplish the same thing by raising the numbers up without extending the dates? Would it be just as effective? I think it's more of a question, I apologize, than a comment. But
I think the majority, the reason that the CWMUs are requesting the extension is because of the migration of the animals and the timing of the animals being on their property. And I think the reason that the division, the regions are in agreement with this is because they provide valuable winter range for these animals. So yet earlier in the season, if they increase the number of permits, if the elk aren't there, then they really can't take advantage of that. And so when they ask for the extension, it's normally because the animals do come onto the property at a later time, usually are wintering there or close in close proximity. They're providing a valuable habitat, and they would like to be able to utilize that. Some of the other reasons they do that for is just to, it's providing a better hunt because of the timing of the elk being on these on the, some of the CWMUs, providing a better hunt for both public and private hunters, because when they do that, when they request the extension, the public hunters have to be able to hunt during that time period also, if they request it. So.
And the question, the last comment is just the person that spoke with me brought up a point. I'd like to know how to answer to him, is if they have property higher on the mountain and they're trying to manage the CWMU or something like that, they're trying to manage it as the animals leave there, then those lower or people that have the mountain or the property lower down the mountain are killing a lot of the animals that they keep up during the summer and range, and so that.
And this is where the biologist in negotiation with the CWMUs should be taking this into consideration, that everybody's drawing from the same pool of animals, and the people higher up on the mountain have a right to those certain time of year. They move on to other properties, that provide a valuable habitat also, and so that's where they limit the numbers on. They look very carefully at the numbers that are harvested on these CWMUs. One of the parts of the application is it has them identify any adverse impacts to neighboring landowners, which that might be one. So, does that help? Okay.
Any other comments and or motion? Yeah, John.
I make a motion that we accept the divisions, CWMU and Landowner Association, R657-37, and allow the deer tags to be taken off the Jacobs Creek.
Okay, so this, I think we'll vote on the management plans first. R657-37 will come later. So.
Okay.
If the motion would be to accept the management plan as presented and then remove the deer for 2016 from the Jacobs Creek CWMU?
Yes.
Okay. Do we have a second? Okay, Craig. Second. So we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Okay, all in favor? Raise your hand, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. It's unanimous. Next, landowner association permits numbers for 2016. Scott.
You guys get to hear a lot of me tonight. Let's see. The next thing I will be presenting is the recommendations for the 2016 Landowner Association permits. Currently we have 12 landowner associations that were approved in 2015 with 3 years with no requested changes. Last year, we changed the landowner permit rule that the landowner associations fall under to go to a three-year program similar to what the CWMUs do, so they don't have to reapply every year. So we have 12 of those that are currently already approved with no changes. We have one split recommendation I'll explain that. One new landowner association requested. There's one landowner association that has a change request and two landowner associations that are in the system that receive less than one permit a year. And so they don't either of those will not receive permits for 2016. So total numbers for, there's a total of 17 landowner associations in the state. And these are the permits that would be allocated to those. And these permits come in the form of vouchers. They're given to the landowner associations. They submit a distribution plan to the Wildlife Board that is approved. They're supposed to follow that plan to distribute their permits among their members. We don't get involved in that part of it. But there would be 113 deer permits, one management buck permit, 73 elk permits, and 9 pronghorn permits total statewide. These numbers are based on the approval of our recommendations. So we have one split recommendation. This is on the Book Cliffs. Book Cliffs had a substantial reduction in acreage, and causes the region to go through and create some pretty detailed maps looking at habitat and the habitat that was enrolled in the Book Cliffs Landowner Association. They had about a third reduction in their acreage, and so they qualified for less permits. The Book Cliffs Landowner Association is requesting 15 permits, deer permits. They qualify by acreage and habitat for 13, and so the division's recommendation would be what they qualify for, and that would be 13 permits. So they are requesting 15 permits. The Book Cliffs Elk, they have previously had 9 permits. In the past, they're requesting 9 permits again because of the acreage of elk habitat and where the lands, the elk habitat or the private lands, the elk habitats it's contained in those, they qualify for 3 permits. The division's recommendation is 6 permits, and that is based on an increased, the landowner association properties have a higher use than the other habitats within the unit. And they also have substantial crop damage from these elk on there, so we're recommending for compensation for that. An additional 3 permits. And so that's the split recommendation on that one. We have one new landowner association application. It's the Oak Creek down in the southern region. They've enrolled 31,429 private acres. This is 96% of all the private acres in the unit, so they basically have almost all of the private landowners enrolled there. What they qualify by habitat in the unit is for 6 deer, and the division recommends that the division recommendation would be for 6 deer permits. There's a landowner association change request. This is the Paunsagaunt Landowner Association. In the past, they have qualified for more permits. They have opted not to take those. They did increase their acreage, and what they do qualify for is 5 permits. They're requesting 5 permits, and so since they do qualify for that, that's our recommendation would be for those 5 permits. And that's it for the landowner associations. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the public regarding the presentation? RAC? Questions on landowner association permit numbers? Okay, comments from the public. We have no cards. Anybody wish to comment? Comments from the RAC and or motion?
Bryce.
Make a motion. We approve the presentation as presented.
Second. Okay, Russ. We have a motion and a second to approve the presentation as presented. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimous. Last agenda item, R657-37 CWMU rule amendments.
Must be wearing you guys down. You're getting pretty silent. I should bring my glasses up here. The next item I have is changes. These are recommended changes to the CWMU Rule 657-37. Every so many years, every 5 years, we have a review of the rule and recommend changes. And it was actually supposed to be done last year, but some things prevented us from doing that. So it was done in 2015. And the following will be the recommended rule changes. But just kind of going in a little bit of background on the CWMUs, half of Utah's 54.3 million acres is in private ownership. Yet 60% of Utah's big game winter range exists on private land. And this is one of the reasons that we actually went into the CWMU program. And it started out in 1990 as an experimental posted hunting unit program. In 1993, it was made a permanent part of Utah code. In 1997, it went to a little more user-friendly name called Cooperative Wildlife Management Unit Programs. And currently we have 2.26 million acres enrolled in the program with about 605 landowners. So what we went through a process in several meetings in 2015 with the CWMU Advisory Committee and division representatives. By rule, it's a responsibility of the CWMU Advisory Committee to review the operation of the CWMU program. And the CWMU Advisory Committee consists of two sportsman representatives, two CWMU representative, one agricultural representative, one at-large public representative, one elected official, one RAC chairperson or RAC member, and our wildlife section chief is the chair of this. And so the following recommendations are the product of the series of these meetings internally with our division, with the committees, and recommendations that came with them, from them. These are kind of all over the place and within our rule. I tried to group these the best I could. Everything is a change, but I broke them basically into changes, additions or amendments, and clarifications. But they're all basically changes to the rule. So the first change that we propose is the change of the hunt dates for buck pronghorn and antlerless hunt dates for deer, elk, and doe pronghorn. The buck pronghorn currently, we wanted to make this consistent with what the CWMUs are allowed to allow archery buck hunting beginning with archery equipment, the opening of the archery, the statewide archery hunt. We wanted to make that mirror pronghorn mirror that. Currently, pronghorn can only be hunted from September 1st until October 31st, and so this would give them an extension of about 2 weeks, and usually the statewide archery buck hunt, which is limited entry, starts the Saturday nearest the August 15th, and I believe this year it would begin begin the 20th. So it's just giving an archery opportunity a few weeks earlier for them, the same as we have for deer. Currently the antlerless seasons for them begin the 15th of August. Excuse me, 15th of August. And to make it consistent, when we start, other like mitigation permits and things for antlerless, we wanted to extend that to begin August 1st. That was a unanimous request from all the committees involved on that. The next change we're requesting or or recommending is to change the minimum required days for antlerless hunts from 2 to 3 days. And right now, the CWMUs are required to give 5 days for bucks and bulls and turkeys and 2 days for all antlerless. And, it was also a unanimous throughout all the committees. They said, let's give them another day. You know, sometimes the 2 days is just not adequate. The next change is recommended is to change the variance application process. Currently, there's a one-year waiting period that they have to go through. A lot of times, this causes the CWMUs to sit out of the program for a year. So we're recommending changing that one-year waiting period for a variance for requesting a variance to February 1st prior to the August 1st general application deadline. The next change they're requesting is that public lands cannot be used to meet minimum acreage to establish a CWMU. The minimum acreage is by species is for elk and moose are 10,000 acres and pronghorn and deer and turkey are 5,000 acres. So in order to get into the program to establish a new CWMU, they would have to have at least 5,000 contiguous acres for deer and pronghorn and turkey and 10,000 for elk and moose to establish that. Then they can add, they could have public lands over and above that. Some of the proposed additions we have, since we started the posted hunting unit program in 1990, applications, everything that had to do with the program has included a president, but in nowhere in rule or code has it ever addressed the president. What it basically do is we added this to the rule and defined the president as the person that has ultimate responsibility over the CWMU. We also had clarifying language in there that they can't apply for their own CWMU permits through the public drawing. We don't want them in competition with the public. So, and there's some other things on that towards the end here, too. Another addition is that we're proposing adding an annual training requirement for all CWMU operators. This was something that was asked by the CWMU Association. The CWMU Association is not affiliated with the state, except for they work with us very closely. It's an association of CWMU operators that have banded together to make the program better, basically. And they want to be able to train our operators statewide, have their ear, so to speak, and be able to train them about treatment of public hunters on, rule changes and things like that. But they want to have them basically for 2 hours a year to train our operators. One of the things we added was that we have a program right now for unused vouchers. The CWMU has the ability to donate one unused voucher per year. It has to be donated to a charitable organization, a 501c3 organization, and that voucher can be donated to it and used in the following year's hunting season. We wanted to do is add that into the reciprocal hunting program. This is hard getting into all the nuts and bolts of this, but the reciprocal hunting program is a program where CWMUs can sell permits to be used on other CWMUs that are signed up for that program to raise money for habitat and management purposes. So we asked to have that added into that program. Some more additions are, this is requested by the CWMU Association also, is that Sunday hunt days may not be included in the minimum hunt days except for by mutual agreement. So what it's saying is that if they give them a five-day block and it includes a Sunday on there, that can't be included in those 5 days. They have to give them an additional day unless it's by mutual agreement between the operator and the hunter. Another addition is permit allocations that deviate from the standards. The board may approve a modified distribution scheme of private-public permits. And I know that's very confusing, but this probably mostly applies to moose with very low numbers of moose. What happens is that when the moose Say if they have one permit every year, and it goes, you always start with the first year. Their three-year plan starts with the public permit. Then it goes private, and then it goes public. And then if they start all over again, basically the percentage gets all out of whack. And so they want to be able to have this gives the board the authority to approve a different distribution scheme so that they can keep on one every other year. So it's a 50-50 public private split on that. Another change is the division must be notified of any changes of operator or the membership or acreage within 30 days of the change. That's has been a problem in the past. We always are the last ones to find out. So there's a few clarifications we made to the rule, and these were already in rule, but any decreases in the acreage that are greater than 33% over the three-year COR term, they have to apply as a new CWMU. So it's that what they've determined is that any greater than a 33% decrease is a significant decrease, and we want to look at that again rather than just have it a blanket approval. Any changes in 33% of the land ownership over the three-year COR term must apply as a new CWMU. What this basically says is we don't want the permits to be guaranteed with the property. You know, it stays with the landowner. So if they sell the property, they have to go back to meet all the requirements to establish a new CWMU. So another clarification is any decreases in acreage that cause the CWMU to fall below the minimum acreage. And as I said, it's 10,000 for deer and elk and 5,000 for pronghorn deer and turkey. So anything that changes that cause them to go below that, they have to go before the CWMU Advisory Committee for review and evaluation. And we do have quite a few CWMUs that are currently under the minimum acreage. And if there's any reductions in acreage, they have to be reviewed by the CWMU Advisory Committee also. So some other items. We added language to clarify that landowner association members and their operators, their spouses and dependent children cannot apply for their own CWMU permits in the public drawing. This was in rule. It was very obscure within the definitions, and this is just a clarification that we've always published this in our proclamation because it is in rule, but this is just a clarifying statement in there. We had also other clerical changes throughout the rule, and one of the things I thought was noteworthy to mention is that there was, by the CWMU Advisory Committee that I mentioned before, they did propose a non-trophy youth buck deer hunt. And it's not recommended at this time. It's actually a very good idea, but we couldn't work through some of the definitions and the legal issues with it at this time, so we'll probably be back. And what this was is the CWMUs wanted to be able to have a 50-50 split where the this is hard to explain here. 50-50 split where they'd have to qualify as a youth, you know, 17 or under. And with that definition, the CWMU would, it's optional for them to go into this. The non-trophy would be a non-trophy as defined by the CWMU. They didn't want it to go by the trophy or the non-trophy standards of the three-point or management buck standards of the three-pointer or whatever, because they didn't want this to be a bad experience if they shot the wrong, you know, something that just barely didn't qualify for a management buck. So they didn't want to call it a management buck hunt. The CWMU can't receive any kind of compensation for this. This is basically a donation by the CWMUs. And it was a very good idea. We just couldn't work from the bugs at this time. But I thought it was noteworthy to mention that. So. And with that, that's all for the changes on the CWMU rule. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We have any questions from the public? Questions from the RAC? Comments from the public? I have no comment cards. Comments, motions from the RAC? Anyone? A motion. Joel,
I'm on it. I'd make a motion that we accept and approve the recommendation for the CWMU rule amendments as presented.
Okay. We have a second from John Blazard. Any discussion on that? Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Okay. Motion passes unanimous. Okay. I don't think there are any other business items. If there is no other business, Bryce.
I don't know if now is the appropriate time, but we possibly look at making a recommendation to the Wildlife Board that we change that kids at 12 can apply for these limited entry and youth, I mean, all the hunts and not just a portion of them until they're 14. Or can we put it on the agenda for December?
So that would have been part of the Bucks and Bowls. What we could do is I could raise that to the Wildlife Board at the Wildlife Board meeting that there was some concern about that. We didn't, in fact, vote on that particular item. Is that?
We broke it in 3 or 4 motions as it was, so I didn't know if that.
Because we did then approve the remainder of the plan as, or the Bucks and Bulls as presented. And I think I can make a statement to the effect that there was some concern about that particular issue to the board at the meeting. Is that all right? Okay. If there is no other further business, then without objection, the meeting will be yes. Greg?
I would just like to state I like having the meeting here.
The rack is split on that particular.
Freedom City's so much better.
Yes, I know. We can't make everybody happy, so.
No, it's fun to come here once in a while.
That's right. All right, so if there is no objection, the meeting will be adjourned. Seeing no objection, the meeting is adjourned.